You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. I'm Darrell West, Vice President of Governance Studies and Director of the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. And I would like to welcome you to the 7th Annual John Hazen White Manufacturing Forum. And we are webcasting this event live, so we'd like to welcome our viewers from around the country and indeed around the world. We have a Twitter feed set up at hashtag USMFG. That's USMFG for manufacturing, if you wish to post any comments during the forum. So we have several distinguished guests with us. Our benefactor, John Hazen White, is here with us, along with his wife, Liz, sons, John and Ben, and daughters-in-law, Kirsten and Caitlin. So we appreciate the support of the entire family in making this forum possible. So please join me in thanking them for their generosity. So today we want to look at the manufacturing sector and focus on ways to improve output and employment. In previous years, we have looked at obstacles facing the industry and ways to overcome them. This week, we put out a new global manufacturing scorecard that examines how the United States compares to 18 other nations. And this report is online at Brookings.edu. And the report finds that China is the top nation in terms of manufacturing output. South Korea excels in the percentage of its national output generated by manufacturing. And Poland actually has the highest percentage of its workforce engaged in manufacturing. To see what factors contributed to manufacturing success, we developed an index for these countries in which we looked at the policies, taxes, energy, workforce quality, and infrastructure issues. And we found that the top countries in terms of its overall environment for manufacturing were the United Kingdom, Switzerland, and the United States. And I will refer you to the paper for details on how we reached those conclusions and the implications of those. I think most importantly is at the end of the paper, we make a number of recommendations for improving the manufacturing climate. And I'll just briefly enumerate them. One, that it's important to have a strategy that emphasizes political and economic predictability. This obviously is important for the business community. Having open trade policies as a way to promote international commerce. Providing financial incentives for innovation, education, and workforce development. Deploying 21st century tools such as artificial intelligence and data analytics to upgrade manufacturing processes. Helping small firms through research and workforce development, and finally, improving infrastructure in order to support manufacturing supply chains and delivery systems. I developed some of these ideas in my new book, The Future of Work, Robots, AI, and Automation. In that, I cover the changing workforce needs and how to address these workforce issues during a time of accelerating innovation. And the book is available in the Brookings bookstore right outside the auditorium after this event. To help us understand manufacturing challenges and opportunities, we have a number of distinguished experts. To my immediate right is John Hazen White, who's the president of Teco Comfort Solutions. He is the third generation of his family to lead the company. He's a big proponent of workforce development and bringing innovative practices to his company and the sector as a whole. And he also is a Brookings trustee. The Honorable David Cicilline is a member of Congress from Rhode Island. He was elected to Congress in 2010. There he works on issues related to manufacturing as well as a number of other issues. He has introduced the Make It in America legislation that is designed to retrain American workers and improve U.S. manufacturing policy. Also with us is Allison Grios. She is the president of Women in Manufacturing. That is a national trade association focused on supporting and promoting women in the manufacturing sector. She also is the vice president of membership and association services at the Precision Metal Forming Association. That is a trade association representing the metal forming industry. So I want to start with Johnny. So one of the recommendations of our report is the United States should pursue a strategy that is predictable and follows open trade policies. That has been America's approach for many decades now. But of course, President Trump is moving in a different direction. He has imposed tariffs, and he's talking tough with China, Europe, Mexico, and Canada. Now, you are on the front lines of manufacturing with your firm, Teco Comfort Solutions. How is his tariff policy and general trade rhetoric affecting your company?
Well, you know, as I've talked about over the years at this event, you know, the one thing we don't do is chase cheap labor. You know, we don't move around the world for the purpose of low labor. But in the manufacturing business, it's critically important to be sure we are, at least in my segment, critically important to be sure we're able to purchase material at worldwide best price, because it's a huge component of our P&L. So the tariffs, I haven't agreed with this concept, you know, since the campaign, frankly, because it's concerning. A huge portion of the cost of most of my products is material purchased from China. So on two fronts, number one, this will, and I want to circle back to the whole issue in a second, but this will cause companies like Teco to have to raise our prices and pass some of this cost on. We can't absorb what's being proposed here. The second thing is it's going to cause companies like mine to need to source elsewhere. So whether we go to India or Mexico or Brazil or wherever, we're going to need to now invest in more sources of supply, and that's very costly to a company like mine. If there's one thing I've learned about President Trump is he's unpredictable. And I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. You know, a lot of
some might take it in a derogatory sense.
Yeah, whatever. You know,
you can count me in that group.
But seriously, David. Oh, but you know, I think a lot of let's wait and see what happens. You know, he's one of those where you got to wait and see what the end result is. And who knows if this will really flow through? But I think it is concerning. By the way, I highly recommend to you folks to read this book of Daryl's. It's a great read. It's an easy read. I read it in Lafayette Park the other day.
What could be more appropriate? Reading my book right across from the White House.
Read anything in a day, right? Yeah, sitting in front of the White House.
So let me bring Congressman Cicilline into this. So you have worked on trade and manufacturing in Congress. What role should members play in trade policy, and how is Congress dealing with Trump, particularly on tariff issues?
Well, you know, we have a number of proposals that have both been enacted and are pending before the Congress to help rebuild and strengthen American manufacturing. So Congress clearly has a role, and while we're doing that, the president is engaged in this tariff effort. Some call it resulting in a trade war. But I think one of the challenges is that, you know, in the normal course, presidents kind of go through this consideration of tariffs in a very kind of deliberate, thoughtful way, where you bring in your economic advisors, your trade representative, you sort of understand what are the implications of a tariff, what's the likely response to be, what's the kind of aggregated impact on the economy, both in this country and around the world. And you make judgments, very careful judgments, about how to impose tariffs to respond to a specific problem. I don't think many of us don't get the sense that that sort of deliberative process happened, and that the president uses tariffs more as a way to kind of make a political argument. And I think the consequences of that are we are headed for a serious trade war, and despite what the president says, there aren't, you know, they're not easy to win. It's not good for the economy. It's not good for American manufacturing. It's not good for American consumers. That is not to say there are not bad actors in this space, and the United States has a responsibility to respond to that. But it needs to be very targeted, very specific, and I think with the kind of precision that doesn't have much larger economic implications. So I think Congress's role has to really present to the administration what we think are good principles for trade policy. And then it's the president's responsibility to negotiate trade agreements that achieve those principles. We've tried to do that, but, you know, I think there's some disagreement even within the Congress on, there are some people who think, you know, we should have open trade completely with almost no limitations. There are other people who think trade policy needs to be balanced. It needs to be fair and free. We need to be sure there are environmental standards. There are labor standards. There are ways to prevent currency manipulation that don't put the U.S. at a disadvantage. So I think, you know, we can have good trade policies if we approach it with a real understanding that we want fair and free trade, and we want to protect good American jobs and good American businesses, that it's not one or the other. We can have trade policy which achieves both.
Okay. So, Allison, you work on issues of interest to the metal-forming industry. So I have two questions. First of all, what is the metal-forming industry, just so we understand what it is you're working with? And then secondly, how are Trump's policies affecting your particular firms and sector?
Sure. So I work with the Precision Metal Forming Association. We are 75 years strong, and we represent nearly 800 individual companies, most of which are small to mid-sized, most of which are family-owned, privately held businesses that very much are being impacted by these recent decisions as they relate to steel tariffs. You know, there was this bit of relief and kind of excitement around tax reform as it happened. Companies were feeling excited about capital investments that they could make in their companies. They felt like it was a great position for them to be even more competitive. And sadly, these tariffs have completely undone what was that excitement and that certainty that our small to mid-sized manufacturing companies had. Our members have been very vocal and are now part of a coalition actually trying to take action and build awareness about this impact of the tariffs. You know, making companies, sadly, now less competitive globally, where material, as John said, is a large part of their cost. Our metal-forming industry, metal-form companies, for the most part, are making stamped component parts, parts that are parts of assemblies that are on other automobile appliances in the country. And metal for them is such a large piece of their piece price. And so to not be able to be competitive and to now not be able to source competitively to other countries is really difficult. A member of ours who's been very vocal, Bill Adler, a small, again, manufacturer in Cleveland, Ohio, has been all over the news talking about, you know, places where he was able to bid and thought he had a good chance. He's now had to pull out of the bidding process because of the material price, he can't be competitive. And so that work will go global and go to not a U.S. manufacturer, which I don't think was the intention of these tariffs to begin with. So we're trying to get our members to be vocal, to share that impact. Obviously, we talked this morning about numbers in our pre-con, and hopefully we can gather that data of this larger impact beyond just our small membership. But it's not serving the purpose that it was intended to do, and sadly, just having a negative effect on our small to mid-sized manufacturers.
Can I add one thing?
Sure.
Just an afterthought. True to our system, our economic system, whether suppliers are affected by the tariffs or not, everybody grabs this opportunity to raise price.
Right.
You know, so all of our costs are going up regardless of the origin.
And so often it can't be passed along to the customer. And so therein lies this challenge. How do you maintain and grow a customer relationship if you're then, you know, trying to pass along this additional cost? How do you then become this choice supplier? And so it's a very difficult place where many of our companies are in. And sadly, there's impact with layoffs. I mean, I think it's been shown in the media over the last few days. I mean, this is causing small to mid-sized and large-sized companies now to have to look to layoffs, to now smaller size their organizations and their companies, which, again, was this really meant to be the impact?
No.
Right.
Could not be. Johnny, let me come back to you. So in my book, I talk about using things like AI, robotics, and data analytics to upgrade the manufacturing process. So how is technology changing manufacturing, and what have you done in your firm to introduce technology into manufacturing processes?
Well, we The AI, artificial intelligence part of this kind of spooks me a little bit. I was at a friend's house the other day, and he has an Echo Bee thermostat, which is rigged up somehow with Alexa.
Oh, yes.
So when I came in, he said, "Alexa, play Willie Nelson." So the house was full of Willie Nelson. So I'm thinking to myself, this thing's listening. Right? Not a good thing, in my opinion. But on the robotic part of this, we've been investing in productivity for years, since I was running the company 25 years ago. And as a result of the efficiencies brought by investment, it's not robotics to replace jobs, in my case. What we've been able to do is to take a $30 million company in 1992 with 500 people and drive it up to $250 million with 500 people, you know. And they're the same 500 people for the most part. And that's through efficiency, you know, because the most costly part of any operation, obviously, is the people. And so you want to maximize the power that you have with the people you have. That's my thought. I mean, people are absolutely the greatest asset any of us can have, right? So to empower them with productivity gains and whatnot has allowed families to prosper and grow and develop. And I've never so I think to continue to do that, I would want to bring my company to $400 or $500 million with 500 people. I think there's some real gains to be had there.
Congressman, what opportunities do you see to use technology to improve manufacturing, and are there particular things that Congress should do to promote technology innovation?
Well, I think the example that Johnny gave is a example maybe very peculiar to Taco. I mean, this is a company that has a long record of valuing its employees, who are treated more like family members than employees. But I think that the more challenging example is a company that sees a doubling of their output and a reduction in their size of their workforce. So even Johnny's example, I'd like to see us go even further with the same 500. I'm not sure that's the experience in a lot of manufacturing. Two-thirds of the manufacturing jobs that we've lost have been to automation and the other third to bad trade deals. So this issue of automation is a very serious challenge. And I think we don't have a lot of easy kind of answers to it. I think there are huge opportunities. What I've recently done in the National Defense Authorization Act is to require the Secretary of Defense to do an analysis and report on what's the impact on the defense industrial base of automation, kind of understanding what the challenge is, both the opportunities and challenges, because it's exciting and it helps to fuel innovation and there's all kinds of wonderful consequences, but we need to understand what it means for the kind of jobs that will be available. What will those jobs require? How many will there be? And that sort of impact. So I think Congress has a responsibility to begin to really study this and understand and figure out how do we sort of adjust to what is very likely to be in the manufacturing space, huge advancements in innovation, huge advancements in automation, and maybe not huge advancements in job creation. And sort of how do you respond to that with good policies that incentivize the right things so that we're not just growing manufacturing without growing good manufacturing jobs. And I don't think, you know, I think, to be very honest, I think a lot of public policy individuals and politicians sort of avoid this because there's not a really easy answer. Some of it's about job training and skill development. Some of it's about tax policy. But there's no, I mean, this is a challenge, and I'm sure you have the answers in your new book. But
I do.
Good. So. I knew that. As a former student of Professor West, I'm sure. But I think this is we have a responsibility at least to begin to raise these issues and let the American people know we're thinking about them carefully. We recognize that there are both opportunities and challenges that this rapid acceleration of innovation and automation present. So,
Allison, how is technology being used in your sector?
So, you know, I think the intention, manufacturing 4.0 or smart manufacturing, isn't intended to replace jobs. It's intended to create new and different jobs. So I was recently at a conference a few weeks ago in DMDII, one of these innovation centers created by President Obama in Goose Island, Illinois, talked about a report they recently did with McKinsey. So they talked about the jobs of the future, the jobs of the next 10, 20 years, and they're all jobs that don't exist present day. So automation isn't necessarily going to replace all of those people in present production or at the front lines. It's going to create jobs we don't even think of today. You know, skill sets that are new and different, and that's why these manufacturing jobs could be and should be very attractive to millennials and women. That is one of our key audiences. You know, our small to mid-sized companies, the Precision Metal Forming Association that we represent, they're just trying to now yet get started on their innovation journey. So looking at how does the smart manufacturing that their customers are using and this interactiveness of their machines to production, to output, how does that relate to them as a supplier? The bulk of our members are tier two, tier three suppliers, very few direct suppliers, but they're trying to figure out how do they integrate this technology and automation into their own facilities. Obviously, automation can be, you know, a solution for much of the workforce challenges that our industry has. Again, not replacing jobs, but being one of those ancillary places to which you can find help, support when you can't fill these 300 to 400,000 jobs that we have to fill and many more to fill in years to come.
So, may I just add one thing? I think that also reinforces the urgency of much closer alignment between the private sector, higher education, and the kind of job training space, because, you know, as we try to imagine what those jobs are, being able to skill people up quickly with the skills that they need to enter into those jobs is going to be really critical. And rather sort of waiting until the jobs are there and like, oh, now we have to train people, anticipating that with lots of good coordination, which leads nicely into the Make in America Manufacturing Communities Act, which is designed to do exactly that, to take the private sector, the public sector, the university, higher education, and figure out how you develop these, you know, manufacturing ecosystems for your present needs and also to help anticipate what your workforce needs are going forward. I think it's really critical.
And you're exactly right. There certainly are going to be lots of new jobs created. In the short run, though, the challenge is going to be many Americans are not going to have the skills for this job. So it does place an emphasis on workforce development and retraining. Allison, I want to come back to you because I know you also are president of Women in Manufacturing. So how do you see these issues playing out for women, either in terms of automation, technology innovation, workforce development, and what are you doing to try and promote Women in Manufacturing?
So Women in Manufacturing, we're a national association that I started in 2010, 2011, with a core focus on supporting, promoting, and inspiring women in manufacturing, with a very single focus on women who have selected careers in manufacturing. So we look at this audience of right now 29% of the manufacturing workforce, and our goal is to help them advance in manufacturing, have the right training and education to help them as they look for new opportunities, as they look to grow their careers, ideally making their way to the C-suite. And then equally important, and why we first got started, was to create a network. So I, working in the metal forming industry for 17 years, found that I was often the only female at conferences, events, industry trade shows, and thought, this is really lonely. There's lots of women who are out there who are talented, educated, excited about manufacturing, but sadly, they don't have this cohort of individuals to converse with. So we created this national organization, and we see these manufacturing careers of the future as a very exciting opportunity to get women excited about manufacturing. So things that they may get excited about in their own personal journey in life, these are things that can be applied directly to manufacturing careers. So one of our key focuses is promoting manufacturing, so changing, unfortunately, a very antiquated perception of what manufacturing is. So we've launched a Hear Her Story campaign that we've now interviewed more than 50 leading women in manufacturing, and our journey continues to talk about what a day in the life looks like for manufacturing. So hopefully this makes its way to educators, career counselors, moms, dads, and aspiring students to find that today's modern manufacturing careers are not what they may think, that there's great automation, there's technology, these things that, again, they may use personally, they can apply those in their day-to-day career. So we see it as a great opportunity, manufacturing of the future, and our community is very excited about sharing what they're doing personally, what their companies are doing to attract a more diverse workforce.
So it sounds like you're doing tremendous things. I apologize that you're the only female on this panel as well, given your earlier comments. a question for everyone on the panel, and then after that we'll open the floor to comments from the audience. So one of the recommendations of our report is just kind of focusing on the important role of infrastructure in manufacturing in terms of supply chains, delivery, and so on. So, Johnny, what do we need to do on infrastructure development in the United States?
Oh, That's kind of a that's a softball question.
You can take a pass if you want.
No, I think.
Or you can call a friend.
Call a friend. Yeah, I have that option. In the United States, I think it's more than just the United States, because in the manufacturing, at least in our sector, I mean, we're really quite global from a sourcing perspective. I don't know what the percentage of our material purchases are globally, but it certainly is significant. So, you know, it's the investment around the world in infrastructure. I think it's a big question. Not only in very basic infrastructure, roads, transportation, et cetera. So, you know, I think the supply chain at this point is perhaps the biggest opportunity for a company like mine to refine and to save and to improve. So I think the whole issue of infrastructure, Daryl, and I know that the president is working on infrastructure, isn't he?
Congressman,
so he claims,
what should we be doing on infrastructure?
Well, I think this is actually one where, and I know these are always bipartisan conversations, but this is one where I think the Democrats have really been leading. You know, we launched a better deal for rebuilding America some months ago. This is a $1 trillion investment to rebuild roads, bridges, ports, transit systems, schools, broadband, because we really understand that, and for manufacturing this is particularly important, the ability of businesses to move goods, services, and information to compete in the 21st century is critical. And we have a deteriorating infrastructure where it is very costly and inefficient very often to move goods, services, and information. If we are going to compete, we ought to be looking at what some of our competitors are doing and making major investments in rebuilding their infrastructure with really world-class infrastructure. That was always sort of America's pride. We had the best infrastructure in the world.
Right.
It's not the case anymore.
Right.
And so we have an opportunity, and we really ought to be investing in it in a very significant way, and not, frankly, as the president suggested, which is a very modest investment, mostly private-public partnerships with tolling and fees, and basically saying to states and cities, you should be doing more infrastructure. That's actually not a plan. Most states and cities don't have the resources to do it. The federal government needs to be a real partner and make an investment of resources. The value of it, you know, in terms of economic growth and economic impact is well known. It's hugely significant. So we'll get that money back, that return on our investment. But there's also, you know, in addition to the physical infrastructure, there also has to be a very serious investment in the kind of technology infrastructure, both in terms of way information is shared, the way commerce is conducted, and the security around all of that, both customer data, IP. I mean, there's a lot of threats in the kind of current environment, and protecting the data that relates to customers, protecting the data that relates to your own intellectual property around your products. So we have huge opportunities to make investments in those areas that can make a tremendous difference and give American manufacturers, you know, a huge competitive advantage. If it suddenly becomes cheaper and easier and faster to move information and goods in the U.S. than many of our competitors, that's a huge benefit to the American people, to our economy, and to American manufacturing. So this is one where there ought to be bipartisan support to get it done. The plan we put forth will create 16 million good-paying jobs, will have a real impact on our economy. And it was, you know, sadly, it was always sort of a bipartisan issue. Everyone sort of had infrastructure needs in their district. It's only recently that there's been sort of an unwillingness to approach this in a bipartisan way, and I think that's really disappointing.
Allison, your thoughts on infrastructure, then we'll get some questions from the audience.
Likewise, I think infrastructure improvements and investments are critical, especially for those small to mid-sized manufacturing companies. We talked earlier, competitiveness is critical, and the security issue is also critical. So many of our small to mid-sized companies are figuring out how to protect what is their IP, what is the things that are proprietary to them and their processes. So if we can support in some way this better protection for companies of all sizes, and looking at cybersecurity and how do we combat that, and how do we deal with protecting, you know, what it is that their ingenuity that's supporting in the U.S., it's critically important.
Okay, let's open the floor to questions from the audience. We have a question right here up front.
Yeah, one of the key issues that was brought up was material cost, driving up costs. You have to import your material. It used to be most of the material was provided available.
If we could get a microphone up here, please.
And what is the prospect of, you know, getting some of those material providers back in the United States? steel for stamping used to come from the United States.
Right.
Okay, so the question was on terms of material costs. So anyone?
So...
Go first.
Yeah, I would say that if in my case, you know, I can really talk about anything, but you know, I would go here, right? In my case, a tremendous amount of my material cost is in cast iron and cast stainless steel. Okay, over the years, and maybe rightly, we have regulated that source of supply out of business. Okay. Environmentally, and so we're forced to purchase, you know, outside. There's some of that still done. Some steel still made here, but as we all know, that you're from Pittsburgh, right? We know what happened in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I'm from here. So
okay.
So you know, I think we've regulated some of that out of existence, and I don't see that necessarily coming back.
I would just add one thing. I mean, there is, you know, the only experience I have on this issue is really around the Buy America provisions, in which we require certain purchases to be made by purchasing goods made or manufactured here in the United States. And I've been working on a piece of legislation and reintroduced it with Senator Murphy to really modernize and kind of update those requirements, because they very often... it's very easy to get waivers, and it's very simple. And so kind of tightening that so that that isn't so easy. But part of that legislation also provides resources for some restarting of some manufacturing we've lost. Because some of it's environmental and won't come back. Some of it's just there wasn't the market, but now there is. And so with some support for some smaller manufacturers to get back into this space, we can start buying American-made goods because they're actually made here. So I think, you know, there are some examples where we can do that. Some of the environmental issues, I think, will make that impossible. But there are areas, I think, where we can. And if we can create a marketplace by tightening the Buy American, modernizing those Buy American provisions, so we're actually supporting American manufacturing, and then when there's places where people say, look, there's just nobody in the U.S. who makes this, well, can we help create that opportunity by incentivizing that with some U.S. manufacturing? And I think that...
you can use technology to make it eco-friendly.
That's right.
Of course.
Absolutely.
It's an investment, but it, of course you can.
And investment so we have that material supplier to our businesses.
Yeah, don't underestimate the investment that some of these other countries have made in this. This is not just about buying something because the labor's cheap.
Right.
Right. Exactly. China, I will tell you, 25 or 30 years ago, China figured out that it was a good idea to invest tons of money in cast iron, making cast iron, and they do it well. You know, so there's a little bit of that. So, David, whatever you do, whatever we do to reinvigorate this has to involve, I think, technology is a key
Absolutely.
To that, actually. You know,
yeah. Right here on the aisle is a question. There's a microphone coming up from behind.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Happy to see you, Congress Cicely, Hazel, and Cicely.
Can you talk straight into the microphone like this?
My name is
Sorry, we'll get you a second microphone.
My name is Rosemary Seguero. My company is called Seguero's International Group. I focus on manufacturing. I'm part of the U.S. Congress Manufacturing Caucus for many years. And Cicely, thank you so much for involving women. We just had an event on Monday where I was asking in the crowd a summit, how many women are in manufacturing? No women are in manufacturing, light manufacturing, small things. I am Congressman Cicely. My focus is on global immigrants who live in this country, who are Americans and are engineers. 80% of immigrants in this country who are Americans are engineers. They can manufacture, scientists, they can manufacture. But there is a problem that is going on, which I'll talk to you later in your office later. How can we include them? Immigrants make America great. They still make America great. They are here. So how do we make this happen? Because there is some strain of some kind, which I'll talk to you in your office later. So how do we involve this with the Congress to look so that we can also make America great? We are Americans. Live in this country. We want to see it great. Thank you so much. And Cicely, thank you for your work and supporting women. We'll talk later. Thank you very much.
Okay, so the role of immigrants in American manufacturing.
Yeah, I'll say at the outset, I think America is already great. So, but I think you're right. I mean, what we have a responsibility to do is recognize that every generation of immigrants has renewed this great democracy and made enormous contributions to our country, to the economy of our country, have brought great talent and ingenuity and innovation. And to the extent that we're not tapping into all of that talent, it is at our own peril. And I think the first thing we need to do is pass a bipartisan comprehensive immigration bill so we make sure that folks can, you know, work and contribute and come out of the shadows. And we have a piece of legislation that has been introduced that has been always enjoyed bipartisan support. If it came to the floor, it would pass. The Speaker has refused to bring that bill to the floor. But I think, you know, we have a responsibility to fix our broken immigration system and to be sure that we have the opportunity to continue to be a place where people come to build a better life for themselves and their family and bring enormous talent. And this is a challenge because we have, as you say, people who come with incredible skill and very often can't work because they don't have the proper documentation, the proper work papers, whatever. That's, you know, those folks are now going to other parts of the world, which is a real disadvantage to the U.S. We want to be the place that those great scientists and great engineers and great innovators think about coming to create a company and create jobs and success. So this is an urgent priority, not only for the kind of humanitarian implications of having a broken immigration system, we're seeing that play out every day, but also because of the impact it has on the short-term and long-term economic health. So I think you're 100% right.
This gentleman right here has a question. There's a microphone coming over to you.
Thank you. I would like to ask, how do you see China 2025 could impact the future of U.S. manufacturing competitiveness? And do you think positive, negative, or why the U.S. should be concerned about it?
China 2025.
I mean, I'll speak to it. I mean, I think, look, China is a competitor to the United States in the area of manufacturing. There's no question about it. They have invested in developing a strategy around it, a very kind of specific and detailed strategy. They, of course, have the advantage of being able to execute it in a kind of because of the central control of the government and virtually unlimited resources to sort of execute it. We're competing in a different way with an economy that's a free market and a government that is not centrally controlled in the same way. So I think we should recognize that. It's a challenge. They're also very focused on making sure that they expand their markets and make the kind of the transportation of their goods easy. And I think we will continue to have a huge competitive advantage in terms of innovation and the kind of design and sort of creative component of manufacturing that the U.S. still is a leader in. I think it's going to take a long time to catch up, but it's not a position we're going to hold forever if we're not careful. So investing in STEAM and STEM and investing in, career tracks for young people who want to think about a career in manufacturing and engineering and math and design and understanding those kind of intersections. So I think we have to recognize, you know, the U.S. has competitors in this space, and we need to make the right investments to be sure that we can continue to compete successfully. And I think in many ways, China 2025 is going to drive the U.S., I hope, to develop a national manufacturing policy, to invest really seriously in infrastructure, to be serious about STEAM education. And I think it's going to cause us to be sort of step up our game.
Johnny, you want to add?
I think that's spot on. And I think that, there's a lot of people in China to be employed, right? And so their strategy is somewhat revolving around that to whatever extent. Also, their investment in quality has been significant. You know, it's not what we knew 30 years ago or more. And so I think there's always going to be things that if you want to take China, you can say this about any place, but there's always going to be things that they do better than we do, or that we don't do, that supplement what we do. Okay, just like we talked about sourcing material. Okay, and so I think there's a real significant role for China, obviously just by their mass, right? But also their abilities and capabilities to support it. Remember, every day that goes by, this is not happening slowly. Every day that goes by, this world is becoming much smaller, much with and with the whole advent of what do you call it, the artificial intelligence, things are now happening without us, right? Data is being transmitted, the thoughts are being memorized. It's quite amazing. So I think there's a place for all of us coming together as we move forward. Right now it's a bit of a, you know, but I think that will settle out.
Allison, how does China affect the metal forming industry, if at all?
I think there's motivation there. So I think, similar to your point, I think it's going to motivate small to mid-sized manufacturers to explore how to become more competitive, how to integrate technology into their everyday operations. There's global competitiveness everywhere, and so these companies, especially these privately held companies, need to innovate, and I think this will be a motivator for them to do so.
David, I just want to David, you had an interesting a point too, and I think you just tagged onto it, Allison. Years ago in my business, my biggest competitor, one night, over the telex machine. Do you know what a telex is? dropped the price 40% of our core product, and we weren't making money on it to begin with, and it forced us. It forced us to either stay in or get out, right? We stayed in, and we became a world leader because they pushed us to improve. And I think not only China, but some of these other magnificent countries who are coming out of their shell, right, are going to force us to continue to improve, you know. And it's a good thing. It's the best thing that could happen to us. So I think there's a real partnership there, you know, in what's happening.
Okay, other questions?
Sorry.
In the back, there's a microphone coming from over there.
Hey, good morning, Mario Rubello. First, two-part question. First part is for Congressman Cicilline.
If you could hold the microphone up.
Sure.
If you tell us where you're from.
Yeah, right? Where are you from?
From Providence, Rhode Island, Fox Point. Two-part question. First part for the congressman, my congressman. What should be the role of states or cities in advancing U.S. manufacturing, knowing that we have some speed bumps here at the federal level and also within Congress? Let's admit it. But what are some of the things that states and cities should be doing to address these issues? Because I think that's very important. Then the second part is for John, knowing that you're in a high-cost state, especially for manufacturing, and there's very little of it in Rhode Island. We need more of it. What would you say is really the one or two things on a go-forward basis that both the state and the city need to do to really help you move to that $500 million growth of your company? Because I think this, so it's a two-part question, but still related, and we just would welcome your input.
So I would say, for states, at least for the New England states, for sure, you know, listening to what manufacturers tell you they need to be successful and to grow, for sure addressing the issue of energy costs, a very big issue for manufacturers, particularly manufacturers that consume a lot of energy. So being smart about investments you're making to increase your ability to access low-cost energy and reducing the cost of energy. I think two is workforce development, making sure that you are really investing both in the kind of career and technical schools and, you know, early ways to kind of change, as Allison said, sort of the old narrative about what manufacturing is, so young people think about a career in manufacturing. I think we're getting out of a period when people thought manufacturing was dark and dirty and unhealthy and unsafe. And if a kid came home and said, "Mom, Dad, I want to be a manufacturer," they said, "No, you're not." You know, we have to change that, and we can do a lot in our education system and career and technical schools to change that. But investing in a really serious job training and education program that has a manufacturing track to it. And then I think thinking about what are available at the state and local level in terms of economic development tools and tax policy and enterprise zones to create spaces to bring down the cost of manufacturing. Maybe one of the only good things, in my view, in the tax bill that was passed by the Republicans in the House was a provision that allows the designation of enterprise zones and communities that can really be used to help support manufacturing. So I would say those three areas would be the three priorities I would recommend.
So I think it's an interesting question. You know, what can cities and town, the states do? You know, as we've begun to evolve TACO over the last couple of years, we've hit this period that I call a threshold period where we must now jump to a whole different company than we have been for the last 30 years. So we brought in some outside consultants to work with us, a guy from Detroit named Larry Simon, who, in my opinion, has been one of the greatest blessings that's ever walked through the front door. And the reason is because he's forced us to think differently. And so we're turning rocks all over the place. And I'm going to answer your question just really, really basically. From my standpoint, I've never been a big fan of having the government involved in what I do. But I do find in the past 6 or 8 months that we've begun to ask the questions. How can you help us? I get Alan Fungin, the mayor of Cranston, we're the largest employer in the city of Cranston, a couple of months ago and said, what can you do to help? Well, they changed our property tax program, right? Not bazillions of dollars, but you know what? Every bit counts. And it's a matter of thinking differently. So now we've gone to the state and we brought in the economic, the commerce people to see what the state can do. I don't know what's there. I've never looked. I've never asked. But I think that in the state of Rhode Island, when you have a TACO, okay, who's one of the last, you know, remaining manufacturers of its size, employing that many people, it's in everybody's best interest to find ways to help it stay there, you know, because it is a high-cost state. And look, I was born and raised there. For me to run a business there is not so complicated. But to bring somebody in to that place... It's a very small state with, you know, quite interrelated with one another all over the place, and so it'd be hard to have somebody bring their business there and get it. I was born and raised there, so I get it. Right? I'm one of those, probably one of the parts of the problem. But
small state with big ideas.
Small state with big ideas and a couple of big fish in that little tiny pond, right? But you know, it's a matter of asking questions, and they're coming forth. That's a very basic answer, you know, but...
Allison, your thoughts on what states and cities can do?
Well, I think likewise, it's about partnership and communication. So as you talked about kind of seeking information, going to kind of the state level and figure out what are those programs and activities that we can do to perhaps get funding to be supplemented. You know, yesterday at our headquarters in Cleveland, Ohio, we had someone come from TAC, asking how can we reach your small to mid-sized members in all of the states to talk to them about how we can help save them $75,000. So there's programs like that all over the country, and sadly there's miscommunication and a lack of communication between agencies and the state and federal government too often to these manufacturers to help them be aware of all of these opportunities to save money, to cut costs. Apprenticeships is a big thing for our manufacturing member companies. So figuring out a way that's more affordable for companies to invest in apprenticeship programs is hugely important. Many of our companies, especially on the East Coast, they want to have apprentices. They want to have a real formalized program, but so often it's really difficult and costly for them as a small to mid-sized manufacturer. So how do we offset that cost? We have to build this new generation, this next generation of manufacturing talent, and making it difficult and costly for small to mid-sized manufacturers, again, doesn't make sense.
Rhode Island is looking very carefully at this.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have time for one more question. There's a gentleman right here on the aisle. There's a microphone coming over to you.
Thank you. Sandy Apgar, CSIS. What's the role of think tanks, not just Brookings, but AEI, CSIS, and so on, in this resurgence, manufacturing resurgence?
critical.
And what we're trying to do is both research and policy advocacy. So research, just so we get an understanding of what's going on. My colleague Mark Muro is here from our Metropolitan program. So they do a lot of work on geographic disparities. What are the cities that are doing well? What are the cities that are doing poorly? So I think there's a wealth of research that comes out of the institution. But then secondly, we're not doing research just for the sake of doing research. We want research that actually has an impact. So in the books that we write, the reports we put out, the blog posts that we write, we always try and focus on recommendations. Like, there always are particular problems, but we don't want to focus just on the problem. What can we do about the problem? So that's what we're trying to do. And I think through Johnny's help, the manufacturing initiative that we have put together here is designed to really push that to a much higher level so that there will be even more activities.
I think this is one of the only programs of its type actually in a think tank.
May I just add one thing? I think the other thing that think tanks, Brookings is a great example, but other think tanks as well, also doing an evaluation about a particular policy proposal. You know, we generate lots of ideas in Congress that we think are swell, but it's always useful to have an outside validator who's actually done an analysis and said this will work as it's intended to work, or this won't work as it's expected to work. So I think that outside analysis and then either validation or criticism is very, very valuable.
And just to add one quick footnote to that, we just published a blog post in which we suggested that, you know, when we kind of think ahead to the workforce over the next 10, 20, and 30 years, like, it's going to be a time of great change, lots of technology innovation, changes in business models. We need an appropriate policy response for that new reality. But it's not always clear, you know, what the best programs are going to be. So in this blog post, we suggested that what states should be doing, what the federal government should be doing, is starting to run a bunch of pilot projects to test different ideas, liberal ideas, moderate ideas, conservative ideas, with an evaluation component so that we can actually start to think about how we can respond but have our responses informed by evidence. So I think that's an idea that we should push. We're out of time on this panel, but I want to thank John Hazen White, Congressman Cicilline, and Allison. Great job, and then we'll move to our next panel.
Great to meet you.
Thank you as well. We have to get unhooked, right?
Yeah,
just nice to meet
you.
I would love to.
Welcome to the next panel, everybody. I'm Shou Chandra. I'm a reporter with Bloomberg News, and I'll be the moderator today for the panel on global perspectives in manufacturing. With me are Barry Bosworth, Senior Fellow Economic Studies at Brookings, Mary Hallward-Riemeyer, Senior Economic Advisor, Finance, Competitive, and Innovation at the World Bank, and then Sri Ramaswamy, Partner, McKinsey & Company, and McKinsey Global Institute. With that, let's get started. When you look at U.S. manufacturing, and we heard from the panel before, things are picking up. Manufacturing is on a roll when you look at output and you look at employment in U.S. manufacturing. And then you look at the U.S. in the context of the rest of the world, the picture is a little more mixed, a little less rosy, if you will. And the global landscape is now changing further because of the Trump administration's changing stance on trade and tariffs, which is dominating the headlines even as we gather here. And being a news person, I couldn't help getting tempted to start the discussion with the first question on the tariff wars. So a broad question for each of you. What is the biggest long-term and short-term risk for U.S. manufacturing from the trade war? Quite simply, can the U.S. manufacturing sector withstand the challenge from the tariff wars? And is there even an opportunity to come out more competitive on the global stage? Let's start with Barry.
No, I don't think so. We try to sell these sort of trade wars that's now broken out as winners and losers. I think the right way to look at it is everybody's a loser. I just hope that I'll lose less than you. But that's what's going to happen. American consumers are going to be a major loser because they're going to have to pay higher prices. Most of these costs will simply be passed on to consumers. And if we target China, then I suppose it's the Chinese imports that will go up the most in price. But you can buy from lots of other countries. So that will moderate the extent of the increase. But I think we're going to lose. The trouble with doing this in today's world is the president doesn't seem able to understand, and his advisors understand, that this is a global economy. It's no longer a national economy. We compete on a global stage. We produce globally. For example, maybe the best one is Apple Computer Company. Apple does not produce a single thing in the United States. It produces everything abroad. It sells in the United States. And most of its ideas are created in the United States. I mean, its research and development is here, and then it's farmed out to Asia for production. Everybody does what they're best at. And I don't see a way, when you start putting barriers in that process, to think that we can be a winner out of that process. You can't go back in time. I wish I could, but I realize I can't. And I think it's time for the president to realize you can't turn back the clock.
Mary, thoughts on this?
So sort of two responses. I think the other element that it enters into this is levels of uncertainty. Right, there was on the first panel sort of a question about unpredictability. Well, if you're making an investment, you don't like that, right? You want to know what the incentives are likely to be, being able to weigh and have an understanding what the cost streams and potential benefits would be. And so uncertainty makes it harder to make investments, and usually the response is then to wait to have some more of that uncertainty resolved. So I think there can be unintended consequences just by putting unpredictability into the equation as well. And I think the other question on any policy is also what is the problem you're trying to solve, and is the tool you're coming with well suited for the underlying problem? And so there's a range of issues that are affecting this, but one of the bigger trends, and you sort of said longer term, is really about technology and how technology is changing. And it affects both the sort of mix for labor and machinery and sort of technology in how you produce. It also affects some of the where you produce. And some of, you know, moving to this global economy, part of that is precisely because of larger technological changes over the last few decades that enabled real specialization and a sort of fragmentation of a lot of the manufacturing into lots of different locations that have benefited lots of different countries, right? And this is sort of where trade really can be not a zero-sum game, but an actual win-win sort of exchange. And so technology, partly through ICT, partly through lower transportation costs, helped to sort of have much more sort of global value chains. I think at the same time, while trade can be a win-win overall, within individual countries, there can also be winners and losers. And the usual is that, you know, the winners win enough that they can compensate the losers, but that can doesn't always happen. So looking at some of the redistribution issues, but looking at where there can be these different kinds of growth potential, and what are these some of these technological changes that are happening to be able to see where new opportunities are and how to prepare the workforce, how to have the infrastructure, the different kind of ideas to take advantage of that. Because if you look sort of at the productivity increases that have occurred over the last few decades, they've been tremendous. And I think there's a lot of interest in that. And one last thing is ultimately, why do we care about manufacturing? So this can be potentially a bit more provocative question. You know, is it just because they're goods? Is there something good about making goods? Or is it sort of features of manufacturing that have a bigger development impact? Right? So traditionally, these have been things that you can produce at scale, so you can be that much more productive, and you can trade them, so you can sell them into markets that may be growing faster than just your local one. They've been a sector that has absorbed large numbers of workers, often unskilled workers, and raised their productivity, raised their wages, and have continued to raise productivity over time. It's been a source of a lot of technology and technology diffusion. So all these things are great when you think about growth and development. And so what's happening now with technology is some of that labor intensity is declining. At the same time, other non-goods-making sectors have more of these desirable features. So things like a number of services can be traded, can be done at scale, are hiring larger numbers of workers, are raising wages and productivity and technology diffusion, and far more mixing within, quote, manufacturing of services in what it adds value. So the Apple, you know, the iPhone, so much of that value comes precisely in the ideas and the design that happens in the United States and in the marketing and the services and the on services that happen through phones, which are happening in the United States. So I think we need to sort of look, why do we care? What are the challenges and what are the policy responses for those deeper underlying issues we care about?
Three, the short and long-term impacts of the tariff wars, and then we'll come back to some of the things Mary talked about later, and are there opportunities?
So this is sort of one of those, you know, it looks like a softball on the face of it, and then you try to hit it, and you're like, oh my God, this is actually a hardball. So the empirical evidence is pretty clear. Generally speaking, what happens with tariffs is, you know, this tends out to, it tends to be, as Barry is saying, a lose-lose situation. There's a couple of reasons why. You end up with a lower growth trajectory, partly because domestic producers get shut out of export markets, and also because prices go up in the domestic market, and so the demand falls, right, in relative terms, and so you end up with less output than you would have expected in the counterfactual, right? That's one reason. There's a second reason, as Mario was saying, is the uncertainty that you create. In this economy, you know, growth has been pretty strong. There has been a lot of focus on investment, especially after the new tax code and all that. You know, people are talking about bringing investment in. Now you've introduced this uncertainty of, okay, what do I do with my procurement decisions? What do I do with my footprint? Do I make the investment now? Is it going to change in 3 months? I don't know. I'm going to hold off, right? So that creates an uncertainty. And then I think the bigger long-term risk from the empirical data is you end up supporting companies that are not as productive as they need to be, making products that are not as competitive in the global market as they need to be at prices that end up harming consumers, right? And so if and when the tariffs eventually go away, the firms will eventually die, right? That's kind of the empirical evidence. That's the softball version. Then there's the hardball version, which is, so what do you do, right? And we have a situation, and I bring this up because of the title of this overall theme of manufacturing resurgence. It is a resurgence in some industries and for a few firms. It is not a broad-based resurgence. If you look at the domestic supply chain, which is the vast majority of manufacturing output in this country and the vast majority of manufacturing employment, that supply chain has seen negative growth for 20 years. Right? We've had, you know, we have 30, 40% fewer manufacturing establishments in this country. Most of those firms are in a situation where, because the growth trajectory is negative, they have basically moved to survival mode. So you're deferring investments, you're reducing wages, you're moving to contract labor, right? So when you're in that kind of an environment, it's not a surprise that productivity is weak, wages are weak, output growth is weak, right? Technology readiness is sort of almost non-existent in our supply chain. And a whole bunch of stuff has been tried in this country. Many things have worked, but the bigger picture has not changed. And so that, to me, is kind of the more interesting question. So what do we do? How do you actually turn this around?
And that brings us to the real theme of our panel, which is global perspectives. So could each of you talk about what you think is the missing ingredient that's stopping U.S. manufacturing from really unleashing its potential in the world? And are there things that other countries are doing on various fronts that we could learn from? Who wants to go first?
I could certainly jump in with my initial thought. One big thing that's missing
in the equation, and what somebody else is doing.
So I think any idea that you come up with from that some country around the world is doing, somebody here in this country is already doing it. That is, we've kind of been looking at this over the last 10, 15 years, and talking to a bunch of firms, a bunch of policymakers, somewhere, state, local. Some community somewhere, some federal agency, some group of large companies, maybe domestic, maybe foreign. Whatever the idea is, it is being tried here, and it is succeeding. But the question is, if you're helping, 30-odd manufacturing firms every year improving their productivity, and there's, 600,000 manufacturing establishments in the country, you have to ask yourself, how do you get the scale, right? And I think the one missing ingredient in this country, my opinion at least, is this notion of scale combined with coordination and long-term investment is something that we haven't really seen in this country. There's lots of new ideas, and people are always looking for the next silver bullet. But there's not as much recognition of what's actually working, and the question is, how do you scale this up?
I wanted to add to this question, could the lack of enough people with the right technical skills be one of the reasons that manufacturing is facing all these questions and evoking this feeling at the government level that there's a need to protect, there's a need to do something about jobs? And are there other countries that we could learn from?
Well, I think most of it's just, again, inevitable. The U.S. used to do well in manufacturing because we had a workforce very well adapted to manufacturing, the combining of workers with machines, they got skills. We were one of the first countries in the world to think about maybe we need secondary education for all, and the United States did. But the rest of the world is not composed of fools. They could look at the success of the American industrial system over the last 100 years or more, and they've done the same thing. So a high school degree graduate is no longer a scarce commodity in this world. In fact, in terms of educational attainment, Americans are now in the middle of the pack. We're not even the head of the rest of the world anymore. So I think on education, we lost our monopoly position. There have been these technological innovations in transportation and in communications and IT that made it possible to move the production around to individual areas in the world that got comparative advantage. And that's what's going on. It's largely complete. But it does mean there's no reason to produce jobs that rely on people of a high school degree educational attainment in the United States. And most Americans have moved on. They're not looking for a job in manufacturing anymore. We have enormous growth in service industries and others. I mean, you should remember, typically, unless there's a crisis, this country does not have problems creating jobs. We're one of the most fully employed economies in the world. Unemployment in the United States has been on a secular decline for the last 30 years. We create jobs.
That's not the problem. We all want better jobs. But to get a good job, you have to be better than the other person, and you have to have education. That's the big, or other forms of training. And what has the United States done? After we did all this work in higher, in secondary education, we just dropped out, right? We're now cutting back the funding on job training programs. We've largely cut back, both at the federal and the state level, funding for higher education. Wealthy people have learned they don't like to have their children facing all this competition from less well-off people. So there's a lot of merits to cut back on the public education system at higher education levels. And if you go around the country now, there's a lot of opposition to it. So funding for higher education has been cut back in the United States, and we have this endless search for jobs for high school graduates. That's the wrong place to be looking. We are no longer a leader in education. We are no longer a leader in technology. American companies still finance it. But notice who does the work for them. Workers from other countries. They go out and get the engineering degrees that you need to perform this kind of work. And what's coming in the future is those American companies are not going to try to have them come in as immigrants, because we made that pretty hard nowadays, right? So American companies says, well, we'll go to you. And we're going to open up R&D centers around the world that can take advantage of this growing skill levels in other countries. So I think Americans looking for the wrong job, the wrong solution. We don't need more manufacturing jobs. We need to continue to move up the skill level. Manufacturing, after all, I used to do it as a kid. It's hard work. I was really glad I could go on to graduate school and avoid those sort of jobs. I think there are better jobs in this world, and that's where most of American workers should be seeking to go, not manufacturing. We will be part of the manufacturing production chain, but we will not be in the business of actually working on assembly lines. That's a very difficult job. We'll leave that to some other people in other countries who are still trying to move up.
Mary, would you like to add to that?
So my comment was going to be sort of this, the same, and sort of building again on this distinction between the sort of manufacturing and services. So there's this sort of idea of a smile curve, because it has a very complicated shape, right? Smile. And the idea being sort of, if you take manufacturing from the sort of design and sort of pre-production, so all that, the sort of service and idea inputs, you know, that happen, and then there's the sort of actual manufacturing and sort of assembly parts, and then the sort of services that come afterwards. So that can be some of the marketing, it could be financial services. Now with a lot of tech, there's sort of tech-enabled services embedded in these goods afterwards. And the smile curve is sort of what's the relative value added of these different parts in this broader understanding of manufacturing sort of value chain. And it, the smile curve used to be, you know, a little smile, right? So there wasn't that much difference in where the value added was coming from, the sort of design and ideas to the actual sort of heart of that sort of assembly production part. But sort of over time, across many sectors, the smile has really deepened. So it's a much more of a deep U. And some of this is because the sort of the ability to move some of that production and assembly to different low-cost places, the relative value added of that part of manufacturing has been driven down considerably, right? And where the value added comes in is on these services, both pre and post-production. And if you think, I mean, so the United States at the moment still does very well on those, and they take different skills than doing the assembly job. And so, you know, there's a lot of talk of, you know, move up the value chain, but there's sort of two ways to do it. One is sort of to move from lower value-added goods to assembling slightly higher value-added goods. That doesn't move you up necessarily very much. Where the sort of the moving up comes is moving up that smile curve, but they're very different skill sets. And so thinking about the creativity, thinking about those different kinds of actual sort of service jobs, possibly directly in the manufacturing sector, more likely elsewhere, that get contracted in within that value chain, is where a lot of this sort of value-added and job creation can come, and where I think sort of going forward there'll be a lot of new ideas and new kinds of jobs that will get created in that. But the United States certainly has been very strong on that. That's where a lot of other countries, though, are making a lot of progress as well. You know, you sort of think about, the Korea or Japan, several decades ago, they were in that production phase, right? And now you can think of lots of different companies branded, right? Samsung, you can think of, all kinds of Japanese that are seen as sort of high quality, both on the design and absolutely on the marketing and financial services. You think about what's China trying to do now. They have been absolutely in that production phase and are putting enormous efforts into moving up the smile curve on both sides. So there'll be more competition in terms of that. But I think that is a critical area of really sort of looking at. Again, it's sort of where's the productivity, where can you add value, where's the potential for job creation, than necessarily what you label the particular activity.
And I want to reference a great report that came out just yesterday from Brookings. Daryl West and Christian Lansang earlier this week had this cross-country comparison. And when you look at the overall manufacturing environment, the U.S. was ranked number 3 behind the U.K. and Switzerland. And so, again, the question is, how do we improve the manufacturing environment? Why are there other countries that are ahead of us? And not just looking at the U.K. and Switzerland, could it be that for the longest time the U.S. was the global leader and that got us too complacent? And we maybe dropped the ball on some of the things that were needed, whether it was infrastructure, skills development, productivity, innovation, investing in taking manufacturing forward. What's your take?
So I think sort of globally, I mean, there's big long-term trends about what has been happening. So if you look even just sort of 20 years ago, probably 85% of global manufacturing value added was happening in high-income countries. And that has been steadily declining. So it's still the majority, but only just, right? And so China has gone from 20 years ago about 4% of global manufacturing value added to now 25%. If you look at the rest of the world, they have been increasing in a number of different countries, but it's a small number of countries that have really been able to sort of industrialize. So for many, many countries, that's not been as true, that it's been a relatively small share of the economy. And there's been a lot of discussion around this sort of deindustrialization and whether in some sense, looking at it from a development perspective, it's, quote, premature. So you have a number of countries where the share of manufacturing is declining as a share of GDP and happening at lower levels of the economy than some of the current high-income countries were able to sustain. So a lot of today's richer countries were able to get there in no small part through an industrialization process. And is that path open for more countries? And so it's true in three-quarters of countries that the share that manufacturing represents in their GDP is declining. So for the United States, this was actually a long, like 50-year, 60-year trend. You actually see a bit of a kink in 2010 where that decline sort of stopped and sort of more leveled off. So there's just bigger, longer-term kinds of trends that are happening. And it needs to really to be understood in that bigger context.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, there is the... most countries have seen manufacturing declining as a share of GDP, as a share of employment. You've seen that the newly industrializing countries, even countries like Mexico, for instance, the share of employment that's in manufacturing is lower than the share of manufacturing and employment in countries like the U.S. and U.K. back in the 50s and 60s, right? And so there's a sense that the industrialization window is not closing, but it's shrinking. And that explains why there's a sense of urgency in some of these developing economies to start to industrialize. It's also true, as you're saying, so particularly in Latin America, right? There's sort of this premature deindustrialization. They start on the industrialization path, switch over to services too early, and in some ways are seeing the effects of that. I think for the U.S., though, again, I mean, I would make a distinction. There are two different manufacturing sectors in this country, and we often talk about one, which is the big marquee names, the big multinational firms, where you walk into the factory floor, everything's automated, leaving, right? They pay workers higher wages, productivity is okay. That is a different manufacturing sector. It is much larger, but it's invisible. It is hard to find, to identify any of the companies in that manufacturing sector. But that's where the bulk of employment and activity lies, right? And there the question is, what has happened? Is it complacency? I don't know. Maybe there was some of that. It was certainly true that the U.S. has benefited from being the world's largest market for manufactured goods for a very, very long time. China has displaced us in some places, right? And that has made the U.S. an attractive market for foreign transplants to come in, right? And so even when you see foreign transplants in the U.S. market, typically their domestic, the U.S. content of the stuff that they sell is not as high as it would be as the stuff that they've displaced. That's not necessarily a bad thing. Maybe over time it'll increase. But some of that is going on too, right? So it's not, I don't think it's just a complacency, but I'm sure there's probably some of that too.
When you look at Germany, South Korea, you get the sense that there is more of a national effort or a push, whereas we as a country have always resisted having an industrial policy or a well-defined manufacturing policy. But you see a shift now in the current political environment. So I'm wondering, should the government even be involved in making that push for manufacturing versus another sector? For a country like the U.S., where manufacturing is only 12% of the economy now, and we are more service-oriented, more higher up the value chain, is there even a need for that? And are there countries that have balanced things better, private sector, public sector?
Well, I don't think there's much need for it, except if you go back to the basics, which is where our government used to do so well. You have to help the educational attainment of your workforce because there's lots of externalities and people can't do it alone. Despite the current American perspective that, yes, you can, you just have your parents do it. And if you happen to be wealthy parents, everything works out, and we're tired of these taxes that try to give these benefits to younger people who don't have high income to start with. I just don't think we do very well anymore in the United States in promoting a broad-based educational system. And that's one big area that we now rank far down in the world rankings. We're not doing well. Second, I don't think we do well at all in job training for people who do not want to go on to college but would prefer some other level. Other countries we could learn from, particularly from Germany. But there is a special American problem with job training programs. The company pays for the job training, your skill level goes up, and you start, where's the offers? And you just run for the exits as fast as you can to get a better job. That's the American tradition, open, competitive labor markets. And I think there's lots of benefits to it. But what it means is a lot of the benefits of providing job training are external benefits. And no company is going to pay for it when their competitors are going to get all the benefits. So I think we have to do more in job training programs that looks ahead to a realization that it's a diversified workforce. And we're not doing that very well. I think the third area where we used to be well because we wanted to promote networking throughout the country, we had an extensive infrastructure programs, largely done by government. Nowadays, people don't want those sort of systems. And so we don't do much. So I think there's very simple. It's education, job training, and infrastructure. If the United States would do more, its economy would do better. I don't think we should be targeting manufacturing at all. I think they're kind of dead-end jobs, frankly. I think most Americans want to work in something where they use their brain and not their hands.
Yeah.
And that's where we have to promote the level of skills more extensively. And this sort of backward looking by people in my age bracket, whimsical about the good old days, is killing this country. You got to be more forward looking.
I think those are the three areas that government has a tradition of normally doing well, and we can continue to do well in the future. Beyond that, I'm opposed to most ideas of trying to give an advantage to domestic producers. Earlier this morning, there was some mention of a Buy America program. I think that's a terrible idea. As a consumer, I want nothing to do with having to be forced to buy inferior American-produced automobiles, for example. I like transplants. So I don't see the reason to move into these new areas with tariffs and other kind of quotas and barriers and becoming more xenophobic. I don't think that's the way to be successful in a global economy that you can't turn back. It's the way it is. You have to learn to adapt to this new system. I think, on whole, it's brought us enormous benefits. Why we can't recognize all of the gains that we've had as Americans from this system, if in no other area, just the range of choice of goods that we can buy. If we were still relying on American-produced automobiles as opposed to Japanese or German-produced automobiles, think where we would be. So I like the competition that comes with a global economy and the effort to produce new products that are better. And I think Americans do really well at that. We shouldn't be afraid of it. We don't have to worry about a level playing field, arguments, and waste your time over those debates. We do well in this world economy, and we will continue to well if we keep promoting it instead of trying to turn back the clock.
This is a good point. So this is exactly, you know, when you talk about the U.S. economy in the context of the global environment, whatever, this is exactly the point, right? This idea that workers are free to move is one of the core reasons why the U.S. is such an innovative economy, right? And this is why, for instance, you know, if you look back about why it is that, you know, Silicon Valley didn't show up in New Jersey and showed up in California, it was because of the fact that there were non-compete agreements and kind of stuff in New Jersey. California didn't have that. You allowed workers to move from one place to the other. Next thing you know, bingo, you've got a huge innovation ecosystem, right? So it's hard, and I don't think anybody in the right mind would want to mess with that, right? Because that is a unique American trait. The Germans look at us and say, oh, my God, I wish we could do that here, right? The question then is, what do the Koreans or the Japanese or the Germans do that makes their manufacturing sector, if you do want to support it, so resilient? And one of the things that they do is they invest in the commons. Right? And the commons is something that takes different forms. If it's the Korean ecosystem or the Japanese ecosystem, a lot of it is family relationships. So the biggest Korean manufacturers are all kind of connected to families, which means if a Korean firm is exporting, chances are that those suppliers are coming with it. You know, in the German system, it's not necessarily family relationships, but there are family-owned firms. There are development banks like KfW that have been sitting there for the last 60 years, set up under the Marshall Plan, that are channeling long-term investment to a huge number of these small and mid-sized firms at scale, right? We don't really have anything of that sort in this country. And so the question is, what would an American version of that look like, right? We certainly do it in other areas. We do it in housing. We do it in a bunch of other places. There are American versions of these things that exist. We've chosen not to do that in the manufacturing sector. And the question is, do we need to revisit the choice or not?
And do we?
Well, I'm sitting far enough away from Barry's, I feel confident to say, yes, I think we do need to revisit it.
Okay, so let's leave it at that and segue into the global supply chain, which is such a critical part of the landscape now, and especially for manufacturing. With the impact of technology in both processes, production processes, as well as on the workforce in manufacturing here and everywhere else, and then on top of that, if you layer the changing trade environment with tariff wars, not just the U.S., but most other countries also looking at how they can best protect their own turf, where do you see the future of the global supply chain? What shape will it take? What is the challenge for U.S. manufacturing? And again, can we go back to countries that we could pick up from in terms of managing things better?
Just two things. So one, just a little going back to the previous question, which is that policy affects incentives. And so you really want to look what incentives and potential distortions are you putting into place. And if you look, not so much in the United States, but if you look across countries and the evidence on industrial policy, there are a few cases where it has worked quite well. Most of those are cases where it's been combined with competition. And so either it's export-driven and you're facing international competition and there's a market test, is this working? And in a very long list of countries with whatever best intentions, it was a very costly mistake. And so a bit of a blanket statement, but a number of Latin American countries now, a couple of decades ago, really tried to do this behind very large tariff walls, and it was a very expensive setback in terms of their larger economic development. So I think paying attention to what the longer run dynamics and competition and incentives to be innovative matter for the companies, it matters therefore for their workers, and it absolutely matters for consumers and choice as well. So I think looking at all that matters enormously. In terms of where I think things are going in the future, I mean, if you look where a lot of growth is happening, it's in Asia. Right, so you've got China has been growing at incredible rates now for decades. India is growing. When you sort of look out sort of 15 years, those are markets that are absolutely going to be growing. And particularly sort of given income dynamics, where often the demand for manufactured goods rises the most is as you enter into sort of middle class status. So where a lot of demand is going to be growing globally, it's going to be in Asia. And so I think this is actually an interesting dynamic because there's other things that are also happening where Asia is really sort of looking to be expanding its own role in the global economy, anchoring a number of infrastructure projects within Asia, links also to Europe. So one potential consequence is just reinforcing different incentives for those economic ties to really grow. And I'm not sure, again, that was the intended impact, but that is a potential consequence of what some of these incentives might be.
So I just have a couple. So one of the things that we do through the research is talk to some of these big global multinational manufacturing firms, try to understand what are they thinking, where do they see this going. In terms of the supply chain, the global supply chain issue, there's two themes that have been coming up quite often over the last few years. One is around the consumer demand and the idea that I don't want to call it mass customization, but the sense that the demand is fragmenting. So, yes, there's a lot of growth. There's growth here in the U.S. too, but there's more variance of the products that are being required. They're being required in faster cycle times, all of which means from a manufacturing company standpoint, they want to be a little bit closer to where the demand is. Whether it's overseas or at home, they want to be closer so they can respond faster and make those changes quickly. At the same time, you are seeing changes in the production technologies. So whether it's the actual production, additive manufacturing or some of the industrial automation,
3D.
On the design side, with simulations and concurrent engineering, those sort of things, there's a bunch of stuff that's going on that is helping companies realize that goal of being closer to the consumers while still achieving some economies of scale so they're able to still maintain their productivity levels at least. And so that's really where some of the big firms are thinking about where the supply chains might go, is a sense of becoming more regional over time. Not everywhere, of course, right? I mean, but in many industries where the supply chains are more global today, you could expect a little bit more of a regionalization. And to me, when I look at sort of stuff that's going on with the tariffs, it seems to me in a best case scenario, you might end up accelerating that because you're basically saying if you want to serve this market, you need to have more of that, so the global supply chain locally. If you want to serve the European market, you need to be closer to Europe. That's the best case scenario, but again, as you're saying, right, I mean, I think it's not as likely an outcome.
Productivity has been a challenge, to use a mild word, for the U.S. Is this also happening across other developed countries? And two questions. Why is this happening, and is there a solution even in sight?
Well, number one is it's occurring in all of the advanced economies in a very dramatic magnitude. Again, in that degree of slowdown, the United States is sort of in the middle, if you like. We are not worse or more pronounced than in other countries. Why has it happened? Well, one is in manufacturing. It's a contributor to this whole global
slow down. The manufacturing productivity changes are much slower. In the case of the U.S., I would say a lot of it's because the industries that were a source of that left the country. The U.S. is just, frankly, not a good place to produce. And so multinational firms like Apple tend to take their manufacturing processes elsewhere, mainly for the story about Asia, is a good place to produce. So it's part of that. We lost some of the high growth, productivity growth industries, like personal computers and things that were a big part of the story in the 1990s are now gone. Some of it's just running out of things. I always think a good example is retail trade. Big box stores were a source of huge innovation in the 1990s and early 2000s. The trend to big box stores is largely over, even being reversed a little bit because of consumer complaints. This has happened in lots of other countries in the same way. There are new ideas. That's true. There's still innovation. But compared to the past, the ideas are pretty trivial when you get right down to it. Everybody wants to get excited about the new apps on their cell phone, but it's pretty trivial, right, in terms of impact on society. So it's just a lull. I have a colleague, Bob Gordon, who wrote a book. He believes that it's all in the past. It's never going to be so good anymore in terms of technological change. I don't know. That's hard to predict. Right? This could just be a temporary wave. But part of it is, from the U.S. perspective, we become a very unfriendly country with respect to these things, right? We allow companies to create huge monopolies that drive out innovations, right? We claim that we ought to force that on the rest of the world, too. Is it really a good idea that if you're like Apple, you get these enormous rents? I believe in rewarding innovation, but you don't have to give it that big of a reward, do you, or have it for so long? We used to, I think, be more competitive in the area of new ideas, made it easier for people to introduce them. Nowadays, the only way to introduce a new innovation is to sell the idea to a big company, frankly. It's very hard for new startups to get very far. They'll get a startup, they'll demonstrate that it's a feasible idea, and then they'll sell to a big company who will go on and make it more global. So I think a lot of this is going to go on for quite a while. I don't think it's purely temporary anymore because you see it in so many countries and in so many industries. And I think we're too motivated to reward the big guys and not enough on the innovators. And we could use some more promotion of rewards to small innovations or beginning ideas. You don't have to have the big things. But I don't know exactly how to do that either. The computer innovations of the 1990s was a fantastic process, but I don't think we could create it again in some other industry. And let's be frank, it wasn't a government idea, right? It was just a lot of private people came up with innovative ideas at an extremely rapid pace, and a lot of people contributed to it. I don't know if that's easy to duplicate again, or at least to have government direct the process.
Mary, are there parts of the world where there's better news for manufacturing productivity?
I think that the point of just saying the sort of productivity slowdown is something that is true across lots of countries is actually important, so it's not just some U.S. story. You do actually see in the most recent numbers, sort of in the last year or two, something of an uptick again. That's so there's sort of these big, broad cycles. Some of it really is cyclical, so still some of the impact from the financial crisis of a decade ago. Some of it is playing out in the decline in some of the investments that happened then. There's lots of academic debates about measurement and how well we can capture some of the change in quality of the kinds of goods that are produced now. Usually price and quality go together. You know, if something gets better, it costs more. Well, we've got better and better goods that where the price keeps getting driven down. So it makes it difficult, you know, the consumer surplus from all the apps and the kind aren't well captured in some of the data. A lot of them are multinationals with intangible assets, and there's some question about where they report certain kinds of gains. So there's a number of issues in just purely the numbers on how well we're capturing what's happening in productivity. I think one of the big questions going forward, though, is this also sort of a time when there's a lot of investment happening in new ways that haven't yet really found their sort of broader commercial applications? So a lot of what's happening in digital space in services that can spill over as well within manufacturing, you know, you're starting to see glimmers of how that's being done. So you see that much more smart manufacturing happening. You see the sort of sensors and sort of Internet of Things within production facilities. And these are at the moment having more sort of a 10-15% cost savings, which is something. But there is the potential for much bigger gains, but we haven't seen them yet. So, you know, are these sort of the same breakthrough as electricity, you know, or internal combustion engines that really change a whole lot of things? I don't know yet. Some of the really growing nature of some of the kinds of data and ways that AI might revolutionize particular areas, probably more in services, you know, there's sort of glimmers of how this might happen. It hasn't happened yet. So it, my guess is it's probably more cyclical, and we will see another resurgence, and I'm guessing that we'll see some real productivity gains. Exactly how those will be distributed, well, you know, it depends, again, on who is really out there, who's being creative, who is innovating, and really putting those into practice.
Yeah, we're certainly seeing this from the qualitative evidence we're seeing from the companies that we work with. You're certainly seeing this point about there are investments coming in. You know, these are, you know, think about an automotive factory floor where the guy who's measuring quality defects is now wearing virtual reality goggles, right? So it's sort of picking one little thing out of every three boxes. You know, he's sort of seeing a steady stream of information coming. It makes it easier. Well, it makes it more effective to do the job. But it is, in some ways, there's a little bit of a learning curve, right? And so you're seeing that repeated over multiple technologies, whether it's the IoT stuff, some of the machine learning issues, some of just the basic, you know, what does a customer need, the, you know, design to value kind of thingies. So there is a lot of investment, I think, that has happened in some of these big manufacturing firms, but there's a significant learning curve. And that's, at least our estimation, is that you will actually start to see some of these things manifesting at scale in the next few years.
Okay. Let's go to questions. I see a couple of hands, and then we'll come back to, I do want to come back to what are other countries doing to foster the diffusion of technology that all of you have touched on, and the startup culture. Can we start?
Hello, my name is Andrea Besouris, and I'm a financial sector analyst, and in part because, as you know, the local economies often affect the quality of what happens at the banks, and big banks similarly, because they have global reach. So why, however, when we've had perhaps practice of planned things like planned obsolescence, whereas in Germany and Switzerland they don't do planned obsolescence. So here in the United States, and this happens from the level of consultant level, like management consultant Drucker types, or Sloan, and people who, you know, we know for that what do they call that, the Maginot curve. So, you know, as people climb in terms of what they do with their work, you know, the needs and things change. So perhaps all of these fit together, and some countries don't necessarily subscribe to, because the nature of the cultures just makes also and coordinates better with higher policy interests. So when and what do we have to do to solve things like planned obsolescence? Why, where, if we understand also political contexts like how asymmetric war is waged, so why don't we also resolve at a multilateral policy level where we decide to not, where in George H.W. Bush's G8 agreement with Germany, that we would deindustrialize so that Germany could then trade itself and produce itself out of the with the recombining costs. So when it reunified, the cost of what it was going to absorb East Germany, we were going to deindustrialize so that we wouldn't be a trade competitor. So when are we going to solve our own multilateral problems that then brought us the new economy, that brought, because I'm involved with high-tech steel. We had a very difficult time getting high-quality funding or funding because the VCs and the private equity people are all at Davos. And so where at the level of like the Bush people who did deindustrialization, and so come the VCs and the private equity people, my high-tech steel company had we are innovative. We do our job better. We have better technology. So I've lived through this. So, and we don't do planned obsolescence. When are we going to solve some of these core problems that have brought us to where we are today?
I don't think I can address all of the points that you raised, but the point that you made about capital, the availability of capital and the injection of capital is an important point. We do talk in this country a lot about workforce training, as we should, because it is an essential part of what's going on. We don't talk as much about the availability of capital. If you look at that supply chain that I talked about, 30% of those firms don't have the capital even to meet their working capital needs. Right? So you've seen a lot of inventory pressures, working capital pressures being pushed down into the supply chain because of this explosion of global competition over the last 25 years. As a small and mid-sized firm, if your cash is going into just maintaining your inventory, it's kind of ridiculous to expect that firm to then make technology investments and do all these amazing things with machine learning. That's not going to happen. So you've got issues with working capital. You have issues with growth capital, right? So this is just, if as a small firm, I need to go make an investment to go and sell new products somewhere else, it's hard to get that financing. And so that's why I think this notion of what other countries have done on that side, right, this notion of what KfW has done in Germany and how effective it has been through the Mittelstand, that the small and mid-sized firms, I think is an important point that we should focus on.
Questions in the back there, please.
Hi, my name is Joel Yudkin. I'm principal of High Road Strategies, focused on manufacturing, workforce, and energy policy. First, Dr. Bosworth, I basically disagree with about 95% of what you say, and I believe we do need industrial policy. I only agree on the education and workforce component, but that's out of context. I think we need to put it into a better context. I think that industrial policy is not about anti-markets. It's about how you get markets to move in a much more productive, socially and economically productive way for our economy and our society. So that's a very different way of looking at what the government role. The other thing I just want to throw in there is that technology innovation in this country actually began with very massive government investment, mostly tied to defense. We could talk forever on that. There's a book called Entrepreneurial State by Mariam Mazzucato you might want to look at, because I think it basically tracks that perfectly. I also wanted to say one more thing about the trends in employment. Manufacturing at 2000 was the top manufacturing economic category and producer of jobs in 2000. By now, it's the fourth largest, behind leisure and hospitality, behind health and services, and behind retail trade. In most of those jobs, there are good jobs in those things, but most of those jobs are lower end, lower paid, lower skilled than manufacturing, what remains. Though some manufacturing, now if you go on a shop floor today, a modern shop floor, rather than seeing these are very backward, you know, unskilled jobs, you actually need to be smarter, you need to be better trained, you need to have higher skills in digital technologies and so on for these jobs and the kind of jobs being created in there. So, I can go on and on, but every premise that you talked about I think is wrong. But I do want to just throw out one thing, is that you're being provocative, I might as well be provocative back. I do think we need to think differently about manufacturing today and its relationship to the other sectors, because we tend to kind of think it's about retail versus services, versus manufacturing, rather than thinking there are value clusters that make up an economy, usually there are big regional connections to that. All right? I mean, so in every one of those other sectors, you need manufacturing for producing the goods. If you don't have retail trade, requires things to be made to be able to be traded, all right? Medical technology, pharmaceuticals, and so on, those had to be produced. So the question I'm getting at here, and I'm looking to the two middle folks there, Sheree, and I forgot your name, I'm sorry, is how do we redefine the nature of production relationship to services and recast this whole thing? I just came up with the idea of value clusters in terms of really kind of thinking about what we should be doing and how invest and how we restructure our own economy today.
And as you answer, could you draw on something that might be happening elsewhere in the world? Where there's...
I mean, so to me, it was actually sort of back on my smile curve answer. Any kinds of sort of production is absolutely, in some sense, got this sort of cluster of different pieces of that need to go into being able to be successful. I don't think you have any given firm or even geographic location has to do every single piece along the way, right? There are advantages of specializing in different parts and trading. Now, that can be across different countries. It can be across countries. It can be across the street. But the point being to really do what you have a comparative advantage in doing and understanding that the whole thing is going to have a range of different pieces. And that's sort of been something over the last sort of 30 years has been a real shift in much more sort of fragmentation. And I think one of the questions that's sort of interesting going forward is how that may shift going forward, again, with a sort of a bit of a technology. Because it, on one hand, could continue this fragmentation. Some kinds of things, whether that's sort of smart automation, whether it's the additive manufacturing, sort of 3D printing, may have a huge collapse, right? And able to do print the whole thing in one place and not have as much of this sort of value chain approach. This sort of customization and being really close to local markets is another trend. Again, these differ across different sectors. But it's something that's worth looking. These different kinds of trends vary, right? So things like electronics at the moment is big global value chains. They're high value added, something where precision matters. They could be quite good candidates for some of this more sophisticated 3D printing. Things like garments at the moment are not automated. It's hard for robots to sew. They're pushing hard to try and change that. So that may become, at the moment, it's one of the most labor-intensive sectors in the world. Lots of developing countries have invested a lot, have a lot of employment in that sector. It's one where this being close to demand is shifting a lot, particularly in high-income countries that can afford sort of shorter cycles around fashion. And you've seen a lot of garment makers either moving back literally to the United States or very close to shoring, you know, near-shoring, to be able to get to the U.S. market quickly or European markets. So understanding the dynamics in different sectors are a bit different, but there's trends with technology, there's trends with services, there's trends in how consolidated some of these value chains would be. And so it's sort of worth looking at how these different sectors are playing out and the interconnectedness of the different pieces needed to make that whole successful.
Sheree, and then I'm sure Barry would like to respond as well.
I think tactically, I mean, this is an important point that one of the things that we're trying to push is changing the way you measure the economy. You talk about, 12% of GDP or employment is in manufacturing. Yes, okay, but there's a distribution and wholesale sector which has a lot of dependency, as you're saying, to manufacturing. Right? There's establishments in the distribution sector that actually belong to the same firm as what you're counting in the manufacturing sector. Right? Similarly with the professional services or the computer systems and design services. And sometimes what you see is a linkage where when the manufacturing activity goes down, the distribution activity goes down, and so does the design activity. Sometimes, to Mary's point, what you see is the reverse. You see the manufacturing activity going down, but the value is shifting to other stages. And it's devilishly hard to figure out what the heck is actually going on here. How much of the decline in distribution is because the manufacturing activities have been lost, and how much of the increase in distribution is basically because we don't even consider Apple to be a manufacturing company because it doesn't have manufacturing establishments. It's a distribution company and an R&D company, right? And so it's really hard to figure those things out. So that's one of the things we're trying to figure out is can we at least sort out how to measure this thing properly?
Gentleman there.
Thank you. My name is Yaya Fanusi with United States of Africa 2017 Project. Thank you for your question, but I think you both didn't understand the understatement. It was challenging your orthodoxy. And the way you reply to him is was coming from what he's trying to tell you, not to think that way, come up with a new way to respond to his answer. Question.
Anyone else? And then one in the back there. And then I think.
Hi, my name is Bob Akosani. I'm from U.S. Small Business Administration. We actually provide financing for manufacturing. We actually have lots of incentives for them. Curious to see if other countries in the world have other products like ours that are doing better. We have approximately $50 billion that we lend out on an annual basis, appropriated by Congress. And so some of it is not being taken advantage of. A lot of people don't even know about it. Are there other countries in the world that have similar systems or have similar programs that are taking advantage better than ours?
I can certainly, I mentioned the point about KfW in Germany, right? I think this is a great point that you make. We do have, as I was saying, right, every idea that other countries have, we do have it in our country too. We have the SBA, we have the MEPs. There's a lot of stuff that we actually do, and the stuff actually works. The question is, how do you get more visibility and how do you get more scale, right? And that's where I think having kind of a single point of contact seems to make a difference in some of these other countries. I'm not saying we have to do the same thing, but it seems to be, you know, if a German Mittelstand firm wants financing, they know you go to KfW, right? Or you go to some branch that's kind of associated with KfW in some sense, right? We seem to have less of that in this country.
We take one final question, if you can make it a 20-second question, please, because we are out of time. And then you're free to chat with the panelists if they are still here.
This is more of a comment. So it won't be a question. Tony Harvin, I spent the last 11 years working in the largest local university here. One of the challenges I found when I was working in marketing and recruiting, one of the challenges we found is that, especially in our engineering programs, we couldn't get enough students to fill the jobs that American companies were coming, asking us to fill. The skill level was far below, and the volume of students graduating in engineering, science, and technology couldn't fill American jobs. It's been touched upon here earlier about education. So I think there's a social dynamic here that I don't hear discussed enough. Yes, we have competitors, but I think our biggest obstacle for future success is past success. Maybe we've become comfortable with what we've had, and the drive to challenge ourselves, the drive, the hunger, possibly is not there as much as it used to be. When people say we don't have jobs, and this is what we were hearing 3 or 4 years ago, we have the jobs, but they require hard work. So on the front end of that smile of the production cycle, why is it that we cannot fill American jobs in technology, IT, when the jobs are there?
Anyone with a rapid response? Okay. Okay, I'm sorry, we have to leave it there, but to your point, yes, there are plenty of jobs. I did a story just day before looking at the JOLTS data, which is job openings. There were 6.5 million job openings that are waiting to be filled in America, a lot of them in manufacturing as well. And then there was another very encouraging statistics, which is vacancies are exceeding the number of unemployed people by over 500,000 right now. So there is a job available potentially for every unemployed American. Manufacturing is right there in those jobs as well. So on that happy note.
This fine right here. Thank you very much. It was excellent. Provocative. Okay.
Thank you.
Great, thanks.
Okay, great.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of things about.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Great.
So.
I like very pink provocative.
Pardon?
I said I like very pink provocative.
This is. Once we had somebody, there used to be okay, our last session is going to focus on new approaches to manufacturing, and also we're going to look at some of the things that are happening at the local level, where there's obviously a lot of innovation and experimentation taking place. So to help us with these topics, we're pleased to welcome two experts. So my Brookings colleague, Mark Murrow, is here. Mark is a senior fellow in metropolitan policy, and he's written extensively on manufacturing and the digital economy in particular. And then also joining us is Terry Babcock Lumish, who's president of Islay Consulting. She's covered a number of topics related to manufacturing, technology innovation, and workforce development. So, Mark, we'll start with you. What's your general view of the vitality of U.S. Manufacturing amidst the current economic boom?
Well, I just want to first shout out to John White for yearly supporting these great dialogues, and to you, Daryl, for including me in this. And I want to shout out to your work, which I think it's been instrumental in really pushing the technology story right into the manufacturing production story. And great job on the scorecard. I mean, to your question, I agree with, I think, some of the sentiment of the last panel, especially Sri and our McKinsey friends, that, you know, this is an ambiguous moment for manufacturing. It's a complicated juncture. There's genuine momentum. There really is. On the positive side, we see favorable ratings, like as in your index, but also, growth really at its fastest pace since the crisis. I don't think people quite realize that, there was a surge in manufacturing right after the crisis through the recovery. There's a kind of trough. And we have manufacturing now over the last 18 months actually adding jobs at 1.7% a year, output 3.6%. So there's genuine traction in the sector now. And then I would say the game is coming to the U.S. really as Industry 4.0 becomes the main template in the world. New design and simulation tools, automation, IoT, data, all the things that Daryl writes about in his book and we've been hearing about, machine learning, as they pervade factories, that's really, in theory, very good for the United States. It's a huge plus. The U.S., it's 9 of the top 10 top grossing software as a service firms in the world are American. This is an American specialization. So in a way, in theory, this should be an advantage for the United States, a deep set advantage going forward. This is our stuff. This is our technology in many respects. I have to say I'm a bit concerned, though. Performance is spotty in the sector. It hasn't really been as good a manufacturing renaissance as the meme has suggested. output growth, as McKinsey and Rob Atkinson have shown, is not that impressive when you take out things like computers, pharmaceuticals, and medical devices. Basic consumer goods production has seen declines. And in general, it's extremely variable performance. About half of the 86 manufacturing industries we analyzed recently have had positive productivity growth, just half. And most of those were barely positive. And then we've done work on the digital content of industries, the digital adoption of industries. If you look at it, advanced manufacturing looks okay, middling on its adoption of digital technologies, but basic goods manufacturing, pretty anemic. You know, it's not fully adopting these technologies and therefore has relatively low productivity and growth. So, meanwhile, McKinsey's found that 400 manufacturers in a survey half had no digital strategy. I think that's a problem. And meanwhile, for the anxiety about robot use that I think Daryl talks about so well, robot use is actually lower in the United States than in many other nations. You know, and I would say, I would contend that's not a good thing. So seems like we're maybe missing an opportunity here. I've been a big promoter or advocate of manufacturing's importance, contra to Barry's very thoughtful dissent on the last. I do think it's special. I do think it's important. But here we are, the dominant IT economy in the world, and yet we are clearly not the dominant leading IT user in this very important sector that is special. So the result is spotty performance, weak SMEs, and only okay group growth. I think we need to get with the program, so to speak. And if we do, I think there's a potential for a lasting repositioning of this sector. It's something different. It wouldn't be our parents, but it could be a very formidable sector. So, you know, that's my mixed big upside, but some concerns about drift right now.
Okay. So, Terry, I know you study changes in business models and technology innovation. So what new models are emerging and how are the technologies and business models outstripping public policy?
Sure. I'm actually going to dovetail on your introduction, Mark, and I'm maybe going to just ground it, given your metropolitan studies expertise, in a very local story. So to provide a little bit of personal background, I grew up with the name Terry in the 1970s in Pittsburgh, the heyday of the Pittsburgh Steelers. I was destined to become a great little quarterback. I became an economist. That being said, our school field trips were to coal mines, to steel mills, factories. Okay, so this is a very near and dear story to my heart. I haven't lived in Pittsburgh in some years, but when cut with blunt objects, I still bleed black and gold. Okay, I mention this to say that I'm very sympathetic to this nostalgic hearkening back to the heyday of manufacturing of yesteryear. That being said, when we look at Pittsburgh today, we can look at a number of different sectors, all connected to manufacturing. So as we look at ICT and robotics, well, we see wonderful things largely coming out of Carnegie Mellon. When we think about biotech, lots going on that's really exciting out of UPMC. If we want to talk about the giant production mills, I remember the smokestacks when I was a kid. Well, we still make things, but they're largely reuse stories connected to sustainability. We see mini mills instead. If you want to talk about green jobs, there's a lot to talk about here. We look at the production of PVs, photovoltaics, solar cells. This is doubled when it comes to volume, productivity, output, approximately every 2 years in the last decade. So when I think about my hometown, our sky looks different, our skyline looks different. But that being said, as we're still making things, we're doing it very differently. So there's business models, the way technology is outstripping policy, and the business models and the workplace norms that we know. That's what is an exciting discussion to be had.
Okay. So, Mark, I know you look at geographic disparities in the digital economy and has published some outstanding reports that are all available at brookings.edu. How big of an issue are these disparities? How can we overcome them? What should we do about the laggard areas?
Yeah, a couple things. So, first, my mantra about digital technologies, I think we're winding up talking about how digital is changing manufacturing. Digital economies have, I think, a twofold effect. On the one hand, they empower people, firms, industries, and I'm going to say places. You know, these are very powerful technologies that can open up new magnifying dynamics. But I think that there's something inherent in digital technologies that because it maximizes or amplifies inputs, it amplifies divergence. And so left to their own devices, I think that digital technologies create larger variation among places. And you do get this pull-away effect of certain places. I think for manufacturing, there are greater benefits because more of it is place-based. So I think that the digital technologies can give more places, in that sense, an opportunity to participate in global supply chains. And I think, on balance in manufacturing, technology and IT may allow, you know, the empowerment of more regions. And so, and to that extent, I think we have a new revaluation of places in the Midwest, places not on the coast, that can participate at a very sophisticated level through IT in global supply chains, and that can begin to counter some of the variation we see. One of the most important things is for some of those regions to build up deeper ecosystems. I think they have been emptying out, and technology can allow different business models, different ways of operating in a smaller, more remote place. I think we're going to see the emergence of a kind of technology-powered, software-driven manufacturing firm that looks a little more like a tech firm. It may be five people with a laptop ordering up certain, you know, contract manufacturing and manufacturing that way, connecting to global markets. And so manufacturing may begin to move towards smaller units that can operate in Wichita or a, you know, small town in Ohio as opposed to a big town connected to a big network.
Okay. And I agree with Mark. There are tremendous opportunities in the Midwest and Rocky Mountain states and South. But one of the concerns I have is when you look at venture capital investments now, three-quarters of those investments are going to three states, California, New York, and Massachusetts. And so to the extent that VC investment predicts future economic activity and economic growth, my concern is those patterns are going to lead to greater disparities, not reduced disparities. Now, Terry, I know you look at geography in international manufacturing. So what are we seeing there? What are the differences across regions, and how is it affecting supply chains?
Sure. So by way of background, you know, I've worked at Treasury and CEA, and I love looking at our 2D metrics. And I think we have some wonderful metrics that are very helpful to us. But in the interest of full disclosure, I am an economic geographer, meaning I'm interested in the spatial allocation, distribution, and agglomeration of economic activities around the world.
Go geography.
Thank you.
I worry you just lost our audience with this sentence.
Basically, geography is not dead. I think for many of us who grew up memorizing capitals and countries, there's much, much more to it. And basically, what that means is I'm interested in these clusters. As you speak to the potential inequalities around VC, that's the kind of thing that gets me going. Likewise, when it comes to how it is we look at supply chains around the world, and the nexus of where economic activity is happening and how it is we respond to incentives and what is it we do, what do we build, how do we source things. These are the kinds of things, especially as I'm guessing at some point we're going to jump into the tariff discussion because I think each panel certainly has. These are the kinds of things I'm very interested in. So I just share this to say I think there's a really easy assumption that we've made that we have been on this very linear and continual path to increasing globalization. And what I would say is we need to complicate that narrative. And I think whether we like it or not, we have. And so without a doubt, because there has been this path dependency, there are some materials that we can only get from certain places or we've lost the ability to source things anywhere beyond where we've continued to look for things. Now, that being said, we do find ourselves at this very interesting inflection point. Whether we look at these tit-for-tat tariffs or whether we look at what's happening around concerns with respect to fuel prices or emissions, that I think it's actually important while we look at this big macro story for what's going on with trade, we actually need to become experts in each of those micro streams. Because the reality is there might be very real incentive to reshoring. In some cases, those far-field or far-flung international supply chains from cradle to grave absolutely make good sense. Great. But the reality is, and this is where when we talk about some of these interesting technologies or new business models, just take additive manufacturing, and I'll put it in the context of biotech. It's really exciting to think about the potential of bone transplants, organ transplants. If you have additive manufacturing that allows you to manufacture a kidney, a liver, a femur, you're not necessarily ever interested in sourcing that from South Korea, where we do have a lot of robotic density. You have very real reason to have that happen very close. So for each and every one of these products, we're probably going to have to think a little bit more carefully about some of these disruptions with the technologies for what that supply chain might look like.
So I want to get into the policy aspects of this, and each of you have mentioned some aspects of this in terms of tariff policy, taxes, workforce development, and education. What should we be doing public policy-wise in order to promote manufacturing? Mark?
I mean, I would tell you, so, and one of, I think, I love your discussion of the power of local things to determine outcomes, right? And I would say, like, the first one are pools of the right kinds of talent with strong face-to-face interactions and shared perspectives. And so right off, I think that tells us that nations and states should be building up, you know, pools of, you know, not just general talent, but I would say especially manufacturing-relevant talent, which is increasingly that fusion of digital and production. So I think that that's one of the most important first things is how does state policy support great universities, important great community colleges that are connected to local supply chains and understand what is needed from them and what they're and who they're producing, and then things like a valuing of exposure to digital and experiential learning in K-12 seems really important. The first thing almost is building up that pool of manufacturing and really technology-related talent in places. And I think states and communities have a lot of influence on that. So in a global world, those turn out to matter a lot to what you're saying.
Terry, your thoughts on policy?
So I would absolutely agree with that. I would actually go so far as to say I think we need to fundamentally reimagine our educational system. I think we're actually doing ourselves a great folly by assuming that this human capital investment model that we've had, our parents have had, our grandparents have had, where we're going K through 12, we're going to undergrad, we're staying in school longer, we know the stats. I really think that that's kind of a broken system at this point. And Daryl, in your book, you speak to this discussion of lifelong learning, and I think that's spot on. the idea that in literally around the world, we see great examples of people investing in education, of countries investing in education. But if you're taking people up that mountain only just to drop them off the other side because the jobs aren't there, or as these technologies are changing, as our economy is changing, that we, I believe the first panel was speaking to this idea that some of the jobs, I shouldn't say some, many of the jobs that we're going to see in 2030 and 2050, we don't even know the names of yet. So this sheer idea that we should assume that we have invested in our brains up until age 22 or 26 or whatever it might be, and then we're good to go, well, no, we're not done and dusted. I think we need to really be looking, and this is through the community college system, but also for many firms, retraining, upskilling is an opportunity for recruitment and retention. And so this isn't just an American story, but literally around the world, to be thinking about education as a lifelong process rather than just something we're investing in at the front end, and then assume that we're going to be able to be critical thinkers or resilient enough to be able to respond to the twists and turns as we go throughout our lives and careers, I think we really need to kind of rethink this.
And here I think there's a whole world of that I think we've learned about through tech boot camps and so on, which are just one form of experiential learning, but also accelerated learning of smaller, extremely targeted bits of knowledge that can be delivered not in 4 years or not in 2 years, but in 3 months to help someone be able to carry out a role in a local manufacturing or technology operation. I think that's some of where this will need to go. And so we have these big mainframe educational institutions that are going to need to, you know, begin to disaggregate into different delivery mechanisms that are smaller, faster, leaner. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. I think dovetailing on your mentioning of inequality earlier, yeah. I think these kinds of boot camps or upskilling, retraining opportunities can actually fill in a lot of these gaps. And we have some examples of this, not just in the U.S., but around the world. Northern Kentucky is actually a great example. So I believe it was in 2014, there was a program called Raise the Floor. And they recognized they had this very real skills gap. There was demand for manufacturing, and they found that they weren't getting the labor that was skilled that they needed. Well, there also was a very high rate of poverty, specifically around single moms. Well, why were they not applying? Why were they not getting into this space? Well, it wasn't just the education. It wasn't just the economic opportunity. It was a much more multivariate problem. There are transport issues. There are childcare issues. Well, it was actually really nice that decision makers in the community recognized that, hey, we can cobble together this opportunity that was going to meet the needs of women who very much wanted these jobs. They were seeking the training to get them, but they also realized that they needed some place to help ensure that their kids were going to be safe when they were at work. Well, what did they do? They not only trained the women, but their kids, they were getting excited about STEM at younger and younger ages. You know, it was something that was actually beneficial for the whole of the community, not just for that particular firm that was looking to hire.
So each of you mentioned workforce development, lifelong learning, and just as our economy is going through this digital transition, the need to retrain workers. And, of course, TACO has been a leader in this area through its learning center and courses that it offers its employees. So what should businesses be doing? What is the role of government in this? How should we think about this important idea about workforce redevelopment?
I mean, it's funny. I was just going to add a kid to your great comment and call out some of what John is doing within his firm. I mean, it's clear, I think, historically, and we heard from Barry, that, you know, incumbent training by firms will always be underinvested because the workers leave. I think not only because we're in a tight labor market, but because the switching costs are devastating to firms. And I think there's evidence that we're beginning to see more firms beginning to think of their organization being a lifelong or learning organization that itself is needing to change, and that maybe it's best to do a significant amount of that with your own workers. So I would add, you know, incumbent training, such as John has, you know, been, pioneered really in Rhode Island, really investing in your own workers as your primary way of learning as a company and changing as a company is central. So will that just happen? No, I think it's clearly it would be good to add greater incentives for training if it's the number one input. We have an R&D tax credit. There's been discussions, why shouldn't certain kinds of education be part of the R&D process, or simply stronger incentives for companies to train, since it's of state interest, it's of national interest. So I think this is one thing more organizations may begin to look like John's in this sense. So I agree that this is an absolutely crucial area.
Yep. Terry, your thoughts on workforce retraining?
Sure. Again, I'm just going to continue to dovetail on this. We have really wonderful performance evidence domestically and internationally that by investing in one's workforce, you wind up having greater productivity and less turnover. When you have firms that are really switching from being shareholder-focused to stakeholder-focused, I don't say this just to sound Pollyannish. I mean, the evidence is there. The stats are there. Morgan Stanley's Institute for Sustainable Investing has done some wonderful work looking at the full anatomy of a firm. And so when you consider, again, from cradle to grave, how it is you're sourcing, people want to know that they're buying when they have the choice. If they can make a choice between a product that they believe is sustainably sourced and they believe when it comes to environmental standards, labor standards, things that they want to align their values with their shopping preferences with, they're going to choose that product. Now, that goes not just in terms of the external consumer-facing decision, but also internally. So when you look at governance of a firm, when you look at how benefits designed, the reality is that each and every different, again, anatomy or tentacle of a firm, given just how far-reaching our multinational firms are, or even our local companies are, when given the opportunity to make a decision with each and every sourcing decision, each and every hiring decision, firms with greater diversity, firms that invest in their people, firms that care about where their products are sourced, and when it comes to design for disassembly, what happens after you're done with it? Those are the kinds of firms that we want to invest in, and like it or not, the numbers bear out.
And you could imagine a division of labor. If we're thinking that incumbent training by companies of their own workers is really important, well, what should the rest of the education system be doing? You know, one of that may be a more practically oriented education that includes experiential components. Chances for internships and co-ops seem like a natural way of supporting individual firms. And this was especially valuable and workable, I think, in manufacturing. In Kentucky, the FAME network, I think it's with Honda, has built up a very impressive, interactions with K-12, interactions with the community college, but then also with independent certifications that's just imbuing the whole region and can really support what their a big company is doing. So I think that all of this is extremely crucial, and to the extent that K-12 gets better at helping people have a modicum of digital exposure, whether it's a computer science track, which I think everything we're hearing about manufacturing suggests that a degree of not necessarily coding, but experience around and comfort around digital machinery is extremely important. And so it seems like that's one of the new literacies that supports a company like Tyco.
So last question is on infrastructure, then I want to get some questions from the audience. And so we've heard lots of different discussion on the earlier panels about infrastructure, different models of doing it. What do each of you recommend in terms of infrastructure development, in terms of how we should think about it, what are the best ways to handle the investment, public-private partnerships, and so on? Mark?
Well, first, on type, we should make sure that we assume that digital infrastructure is assumed part of the national industry, infrastructure discussion. It isn't always. My colleagues, Adi Tomer and Joe Kane, have done some great work showing not only are there bigger gaps in the broadband coverage than we may assume, but sometimes that the whole importance of this is left out of the national discussion of infrastructure. I do think that a fusion of national institutions and especially evaluation data and benchmarking combined with strong state and local delivery and collaborations is the way to go on this. I think it's crucially important, and it clearly should be mapped into economic needs of the country. Clearly, manufacturing is one of the central areas that you would want to be looking at.
Terry, your thoughts on infrastructure development?
Yeah, I was also going to begin. I promise we didn't coordinate this in advance. I was also going to begin with the discussion of digital divide, because the reality is we have some amazing potential. If you look at sub-Saharan Africa, my goodness, we've been able to leapfrog over laying fiber optic cable. The connectivity and the potential that we have, whether it's connecting smallholder farmers to markets or for telemedicine, we can't underestimate. That being said, right here in the U.S., I mean, I think we've all had the experiences of knowing exactly where those cell gaps are as we drive or make our way in our commutes, perhaps. And so I really think when it comes to looking at how it is that we are addressing a lot of those digital gaps, that is absolutely mission critical. In terms of infrastructure, oh, goodness, having spent time in Japan and to have people apologize when a train leaves a couple seconds early or a couple seconds late, I mean, that is just remarkable. There's no reason why we shouldn't be firing on all cylinders there. When it comes to, goodness, Liberia with a recent Ebola crisis, anyone who spent time in sub-Saharan Africa knows the feeling of being jostled around in a van for hours on end. Well, where is it that you find the smoothest, nicest road in Liberia? Well, it's Chinese built. So when it comes to infrastructure, and I don't mean this just for the U.S., I mean internationally, there is absolutely no reason why we aren't using this time, as we have this resurgence, to be investing in. And I don't mean to be Pollyannish about this. At a time when we have incredible partisan tension and divisiveness, there is no reason why this is a partisan issue, whether it's investing in our roads, our rail, our airports, trains, digital connectivity broadly, physical and pixels. It's just something that is long overdue.
You mentioned the issue about the cell phone gaps, and I used to visit my mother in rural Ohio, and she was like right in the middle of this dead spot. I could go 10 miles north of where she lived, 10 miles south of where she lived, and get a signal, but not where she lived.
Yeah.
Mark?
Yeah, and the mapping I mentioned really shows that there are surprising gaps, close to metropolitan areas. The one thing I would add, too, while I think that much of this delivery needs to happen at the state, local level, where there's proximity to industries and local consensus, I do think we need it to overlay some kind of infrastructure bank or some kind of data-driven, analytics-driven actor to make sure that we're funding those absolutely crucial, nationally significant links, whether it's, critical port gaps, fixing critical ports, airports, big-ticket items that clearly add up to a national, network. We need to make sure that we're, have a structure that can deliver on that as well.
Okay, let's open the floor to questions. There's a couple questions there, so we'll start with the woman and then go from there. And if you can give us your name and organization.
Sure. My name is Suzanne Bergeron. I'm with the National Urban League. We do a lot of, we have community-based affiliates around the country that do the partnership and the connecting for training, preparing people for credentialing and connecting them to the workforce. But we don't hear that role of that cadre of service providers. We hear community colleges mentioned, and I'm wondering why that's not given the visibility that it should be given. By giving them more visibility, you're giving them more access and more opportunity to get the funding to be able to continue to do the service. We service populations that are the hardest to serve. The young 18 to 24 who have been disconnected from school and dropouts, well, we make it work for them. And so, you know, we have STEM programs, and we don't hear, we serve primarily the African-American community. We also serve Latino and Hispanic communities. You have cadres of community-based organizations like that in different populations. And if we can just elevate them to be part of the partnership that's being discussed. So I wanted to raise that question and bring that to your attention. Secondly, on the infrastructure, the National Urban League has been pushing hard to make sure that in the discussions that we have minority businesses in the supply chain as well as in the construction, local hire provisions, and building infrastructure, not just on the roads and bridges, but the schools and the community centers. So if you could comment on that as well. Thank you.
So, Suzanne, I would thank you for the work that you're doing, and I'm not going to disagree with you. I think we need more good news stories about some of these public-private independent sector partnerships that are working together to fill some of these gaps. So you speak to the work that you're doing. There are 17 other programs that I think any of us could rattle off that just make us feel better that there are these kinds of partnerships. Does that make the headlines? No, unfortunately not, but I think the fact that you're here sharing that with people is great.
I think there's also... I think it's an interesting moment where the big tech companies are quite motivated right now to try to support inclusion, you know, for lots of reasons, including some of the critiques they've been on the receiving end. So I think we're beginning to see I know Google and Microsoft each have quite, you know, well thought out basically courses and online tools that can be linked with local and used by local nonprofits or others to, you know, really inculcate some of those first-level tech skills. And I think all of this then can feed into, you know, what I think is one of the really innovative, creative areas of experimentation around the boot camps and code schools, and I think they can be for other exposures, but this focus on short, intense, and super relevant coursework. And all the better if, like as in St. Louis, where an organization called Launch Code actually provides this kind of training for free by making sure that it can place people that it gets paid for. So it works as a placement. So it's a great bridge between these kind of initial exposures, then moving into higher level skills, and then being able to be placed and not have to pay for the work up front. So I think that we now have a bunch of really interesting models, and it's about scaling them up in a lot of places. I really appreciate the work you're doing here.
And I'll just add a quick footnote on the training front, which is I think as we move forward in the next 10 to 20 years, there's going to be significant workforce disruption just from the various new technologies that are coming online, changes in business models, and the like. There's going to be more than enough work to do. We're going to have to need the best efforts of all of these kinds of organizations. So certainly the types of things you're talking about are going to be absolutely crucial. Community colleges are going to play a very active role for first-generation students, for immigrants, for poor people. Community colleges often are the educational system of choice for them, and so they need to kind of align what they're doing with the business community so that their students have the requisite skills. And then companies themselves are going to have to really think seriously about worker retraining. AT&T is an example of a company on a large scale that has been doing a really good job of this. They're taking entry-level workers and giving them additional skills so they can progress up the line within their company. In the very back, there was somebody who had a question on the end. Yeah, right behind you, there's a microphone coming up.
I'm glad, pardon me, that you're mentioning.
Can you give your name and organization?
Oh, my name is Alice Ortusar, and I run the Holistic Medicine Information Clearinghouse, the Well Mind Association of Greater Washington, and I'm a researcher, writer, and editor. And I've edited and proofread standardized tests, and it really sickened me to see literature reduced to multiple choice questions. So I'm encouraged to hear about these opportunities offered in education. And I'm wondering about models we used to have. I was trained by Kaiser. The ad said EKG technician needed, will train in the 1970s. I knew other companies that had very strong training programs as long as they felt that you were capable of being trained, of learning. And I'm wondering what has happened to that. Companies seem more interested in pursuing H-2B visas to bring in workers with skills and pay them less than they would pay American workers. And I also remember models such as the Chicago Vocational High School in my town that had state-of-the-art training after the sophomore year of high school for any student who felt that was the direction he or she wanted to go in. And they came out market-ready, job-ready, with state-of-the-art skills. So we've had these models, and it seems businesses are reluctant today to make those investments and prefer to look abroad and bring people in rather than actually training and then retaining the workers with additional incentives.
I mean, I agree. I think there are traditional models that perhaps we do need to go back to, and vocational education I would certainly put in that category. I don't think every high school graduate needs to go to college. We need plumbers, electricians, people who have good design skills. And so having a strong vocational track for people who don't want to go to a 2 or 4 year university, I think makes a lot of sense, just so we make sure we have the skills that we're going to need. This gentleman here has a question. There's a microphone coming over.
Thank you. Sandy Apgar, CSIS. We know how to design vocational education. We collectively around the globe. We know how to design PhD programs in hundreds of disciplines. How do we design a lifelong learning system when we don't know the outcomes, when the pace of innovation and the scope that you've been describing this morning is so vast, so rapid, that the nature of the learning itself is a quest? I think this is a truly vexing pedagogical problem, but it's also a very practical policy problem since we're investing heavily.
I mean, I don't think this is an area where a top-down solution is appropriate, because in a situation where there's going to be a lot of disruption, people's skill needs and training needs are going to vary quite a bit. So in my book, one of the ideas I suggest is to give the ordinary person the power to determine the retraining. So I developed the idea of lifetime learning accounts. It's kind of like an IRA or a 401k program in which people can put money in on a tax advantage basis. Perhaps their employer could match that. And then as that person sees a need for additional job skill development at age 30, 35, 40, or whenever, that person makes the choice to draw on that account, and it could be for an online class or certificate program. There may be a specific skill that individual needs, but it gives the person the power to decide what the need is going to be. I think that type of very bottom-up, very decentralized, and very individualistic-based type of system is the best way to go.
in its adapted or anticipates or assumes unpredictability. It assumes continuousness. It assumes that you don't just educate yourself once, right? Mm-hmm. And it assumes that you won't be taken care of necessarily by each of your employers, that you better buy these services. So we really agree on this, and I think it would be ideal if governments would match or the kind of deposits into a lifelong learning account, because there is a national or state interest in people being able to adapt, being able to constantly learn. So I think this is one of the key ideas that we really need to be thinking about in the next few years.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and just pile on. I mean, the reality is we don't live in this William White organization man era anymore. And so whether we're talking about the portability of benefits with respect to pensions, with respect to lifelong learning, I mean, we just need to be reconfiguring all of the above. What I'm going to say specifically, though, with respect to any one of our institutions of higher education, I happen to think the most interesting things at most any college or university are not happening within disciplinary silos. They're at the intersection. So when you look at, the sustainability work at ASU, when you look at some of the enterprise and the environment efforts coming out of Oxford, we could look at a number of different schools, community colleges, or four-year universities. Oftentimes, if you're wanting to find some of the most interesting things, they're the interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary. The MIT Media Lab is actively anti-disciplinary. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the interesting things are happening. And yes, I mean, the intellectual sort of like nerdy geek in me just thinks that's cool. But the reality is, as you speak to assuming a lifelong trajectory that requires intellectual creativity and intellectual curiosity, well, getting comfortable with discomfort, getting comfortable with having to think critically, of not knowing the answers. And rote memorization isn't going to help us. But recognizing that we are at this interesting inflection point in our economy and America's role in the world, being able to be resilient and adapt from not just job to job, but career to career is going to be essential.
By the way, Terry, being a nerd at Brookings is okay. Like, we think that is a term of endearment.
Thank you.
Nerd saves space. Yeah.
We have time for one more question. Is there a gentleman back there? Or we can go over here. Here's a microphone for you.
Gene Allen, retired, but I'm president of the MIT alumni in the area, and one of the key things we're working on is the future of work and what it means and where we're going. And most of my career has been technology, to use commercial.
Actually, can you hold the microphone up a bit?
Working technology issues to make sure we have economic opportunity. One of the key features of training individuals is having mentors, and mentors from the family level, K through 12, teachers who are mentors to their students, not just rot teachers, mentors as peers. Having promoting mentorship, I think, is one of the key capabilities that made me successful in any event. And I think I have trouble finding mentors. My kids have trouble finding mentors, particularly in technology-centric areas. I don't find a lot of people really qualified. And I'm spoiled in the nuclear Navy, so qualification really means knowing what you're doing. What can be done to incentivize and promote mentorship to enable individual learning?
Okay, that's a great closing question. Mark or Terry? Yeah,
and that's an interesting thought. It's easier to think of a system to provide mentors when the knowledge is sort of static and backward-looking and more like, less changeable. I do think we're seeing a lot of experimentation. I mean, there are lots of great university and community colleges that are working to build this into every, course. I think this is part of why apprenticeships and co-ops are really gaining traction, because there is the opportunity to to have some connection with someone. I do think we do have to find a way to really to scale up, make it easier to organize. I think these need to be regional, you know, and local, you know, mentorship kinds of networks. There are a few. I think the state of Michigan is trying to actually, you know, support regional trade associations to do this work. So I think it's, you know, I think your question is excellent about this. It's how do, but who, what is a mentor in a time of really radical change? And I think maybe it becomes even more important. I noticed, I think, John, did you want to comment? I think I saw you.
Can I make one comment? Yeah.
Yes. And can we get the microphone up?
I don't need a microphone. But you do for a web audience.
No, I just wanted to circle back and come to something quite basic. For the record, and I've listened to all of these panels, and the discussions have been marvelous. For the record, I'm a true believer in my heart of the value of manufacturing in America. From my experience and what I've learned in my life is that unless something's changed recently, I don't think there's a greater creator of wealth than manufacturing. So I think it's worth preserving, growing, developing. I wanted to share a story, which I've shared on this panel before. When we talk about education, I've heard a lot about education today and community colleges and the role of government and et cetera, et cetera. And I think this notion of intersection is really spot on. There was a company, and I don't remember where it was. It was Minnesota or North Dakota or someplace a few years back that was all the town had and employed most of the town. And with this baby boomer rollover, which is, by the way, a very real thing, because my average employment at Taco is 23 or 24 years. Right? But now that we all rose up in the same boat, on the same tide, and we're all sort of now, well, I'm not rolling out, but a lot of other people are. And so what do you do about that? And this company, which supplied parts to the automotive industry, was having to close their doors and move to Mexico because they could get no employees to backfill. So they went to the town. They figured out a strategy, which I think is quite brilliant. They brought high school students into the factory because these high school students were told by their parents, you're not going into manufacturing. It's dark, it's dirty, it's hard work, right? Well, anything good is hard work, right? So they brought these kids in who saw what happens on a manufacturing floor today. And I can attest to this. It's not robotic, but it's pretty video game-ish if you're in that generation. And these kids went home and told their parents, I want to work there. And the parents said, you can't. Well, then they brought the parents in with the kids. And the parents now saw what current manufacturing looks like. And in discussing it, they convince the parents, and not every kid, unless a kid's going to become a doctor or a lawyer or something, not every kid needs to go to college or wants to, but they feel obligated to. So this company began bringing these high school kids in after they graduated, paid them $60,000 or $70,000 a year to work on the manufacturing floor, and oh, guess what? They provided their continued education. So in the end of the day, these kids were employed, earning, saved the company in that town, and we're educated. There's a downside to that. We provide education for our employees up through an MBA program on site. We have found in the last 5 or 6 years that folks take advantage of that, which is great, become further educated and get their MBA, and then leave. You know, so now we have to work on retention programs, right? But I just want to put one last word in on behalf of manufacturing, because I think it's a damn good thing. And I think we should be proud that we do so well in this country. And people like me are going to make sure we continue. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. That is a great benediction on this session. I want to thank Mark and Terry for sharing their views, and thanks to all of you for coming out. Thank you very much.